Business Examiners to order. The meeting is being held virtually via Zoom, and the public have been properly notified of the options to attend virtually. Ms. Po, roll call, please.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Dinar?
Present.
Dr. Medina?
Present.
Dr. Flint? Dr. Davy?
Present.
Dr. Seidman?
Present.
Dr. Stenhoff?
Present.
Dr. Stewart?
Present.
Dr. Livesay?
You're muted.
Present.
Thank you. We have a quorum.
Thank you, Ms. Poe. So some preliminary remarks and announcements for everybody in attendance. The times stated on the agenda are approximate, and the board makes every effort to begin proceedings at the scheduled time. The board may suspend the discussion of an item, proceed to a new item, and then come back to a tabled item if necessary. And the board may reorder items for various reasons. On today's agenda, there are no timed items, so we'll probably move around a bit. Board members, you know what to do. Thank you for continuing to use the raise hand feature of Zoom, because that really helps everybody who wishes to speak have a chance to speak. Board survey, the board encourages everyone in attendance to provide feedback by completing the board assessment form. You'll find the link on the meeting agenda that is posted on the board's website. I always like to take the opportunity to thank all of the board members and our board staff and our assistant AG, Ms. Galvin, for the many hours of effort and work that goes into taking care of board business. So I really commend all of the effort and attention that everybody pays to the matters that are on the agenda. So thank you. On continuing education credits, attendance at the board meeting is eligible for continuing education credit if it is at least 4 hours long. If the duration is 4 hours or more, keep making a note of the code words that will be provided at random intervals during the meeting. And then you can report those code words to the board staff for purposes of earning CEs. The meetings page for this particular meeting will have a link, and within several weeks, the board staff will verify the licensees' earned credits in their CE broker accounts. If the meeting is not more than 4 hours long, then it is not possible to earn continuing education credit. So thank you for your understanding. And then it is my pleasure to welcome Dr. Livesay to the board. Welcome, Dr. Livesay. And I want to say that Dr. Livesay has attended board meetings for a number of years, so she's no stranger to how the board operates. And I think she has facilitated many psychologist trainees to attend the meetings as well. So she's familiar with the code words and all of the CE stuff that I just mentioned. Dr. Livesay, do you want to take a few moments to speak?
Sure, thank you. I'm so excited to be here. I'm excited to be serving my psychology community and the greater community of the state of Arizona. I'm the chief psychologist at Southwest Behavioral and Health Services. I've worked with many of you on the board in the past in different ways, Dr. Seidman, Dr. Medina. So I always tell my students, be nice and kind to those that you work with, because you never know in what capacity you're going to end up working with them again in the future, right? So I appreciate this opportunity. I'm honored to be here and excited for the work that we're going to do together. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Livesay, and truly a welcome to this. And I know sometimes our board meetings can deal with some very weighty issues, and you know, we are looking forward to working together on many of those. Board members, do you wish to extend any welcomes or thanks to Dr. Livesay? Yes, Dr. Seidman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Good morning, Dr. Livesay. Really great to see you again. Really looking forward to working with you, and very much appreciated that you've volunteered to serve our board. So thank you.
Dr. Medina.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Welcome, Dr. Livesay. It's great to have you. And I echo your, you know, what you shared, that we are a small community, and absolutely, we run into our colleagues all the time in different scenarios. So you're very much needed. And so very much appreciate the step of, you know, volunteering. And yeah, hang on for the ride. It's wonderful. It's a great way to serve our state.
Dr. Stewart.
Thank you, Mr. Denner. Yes, Dr. Livesay, welcome aboard. I echo Dr. Medina's comments, especially in terms of buckle up, you know, here we go. So welcome aboard. Thank you.
Dr. Stanhoff.
Yeah, welcome, and appreciate you being willing to do this as well. You'll see that there's a lot of good hard work in here, but a lot of the work is really helpful for the public. And I've learned a lot. I've only been on the committee or the board for, I think, a year, year and a half, something like that now. But welcome, and I'm looking forward to working with you.
Dr. Davey.
Yes, I'll just extend a welcome as well. Dr. You and I actually crossed paths way back in the day, probably like 15 years ago. So your sentiment rings true. You never know when you're going to cross up with your professional friends and colleagues again and where that might be. So it's good to have you on the team. It's always it's been something that we've been needing as another psychologist added to this board. And so kudos to the governor's office and our executive team, our executive leadership, and getting you through that process. And looking forward to working with you in the future.
Thank you. And Dr. Livesay, I apologize for, I was gently corrected in the proper pronunciation of your name.
Listen, it's an argument within the family of the way the name's pronounced. So it can be Livesay, Livesay, Livesay. I mean, whatever it is, I will answer. So no worries about that.
Well, thank you for your kindness with that. So call to the public. Those wishing to address the public, address the board, do not need to request permission in advance. But the board will limit the number of persons speaking during this time to a reasonable number, and you'll have up to 3 minutes to do so if you wish to speak. Pursuant to ARS Section 38-431.02, subsection H, the board may only take action on matters listed on the agenda. The board members may not discuss the matter with each other or with the member of the public addressing the board. The only option available would be to instruct staff to place the topic on a future agenda if applicable. So if at this time anybody in attendance wishes to speak, please unmute yourself and I'll call on you. All right, hearing none, number five, council update, Ms. Galvin.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. Just one update with respect to the formal hearing in the matter involving Jamie Jones, the behavior analyst. The hearing was held in January and continued to February. We wrapped that up. The ALJ has 20 days from the close of record to submit his recommended decision. He did hold the record open until May 9th, awaiting the receipt of the transcript from the court reporter. That transcript has been received. So I would expect a decision certainly by your June meeting. And that's all. Thank you.
Appreciate that, Ms. Galvin. Thank you. Okay, then consent agenda, number six. Are there any recusals? Hearing none, board members may request to remove an item for independent. Sorry, Dr. Seidman.
Yeah. Sorry about that. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will need to abstain from consideration and vote on item 6C1A. 6C1B, 6C2D, and 6C6A due to educational relationships I had with these applicants.
Thank you, Dr. Seidman. Any requests to remove items? Yes, Dr. Livesey.
Sorry, I need to recuse myself from 6C1B, 6C3A. I had both of those applicants in my training program.
Thank you. Any other recusals? Any requests to remove items off of the consent agenda? Any motion to approve the items?
So moved.
Second.
Thank you. Dr. Stewart moves. Dr. Medina seconds. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? None opposed. The motion carries. So those who got approval to sit for the exams, good luck to you all. And those who got their licenses approved, congratulations. And I hope we never get to see your name again on the agenda. Okay, then let's go to number 8. 8 is discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding proposal from the Arizona Psychological Association on supervisor training requirements. Ms. Packman, will you please introduce our guests and give us a summary?
Yes, Mr. Chair. So we have with us today a person who you've come to know in recent months, Dr. Michelle Melton, the president of the Arizona Psychological Association, ASPA, and with her are two other professionals who have responsible roles, leadership roles with the Arizona Psychology Training Consortium. And so they are here today. They requested time to address the board as they are crafting a program or an initiative that is specific to supervisor training requirements. They do have a presentation that they want to share. I'm not sure, guess which person is going to do the speaking. Is that you, Dr. Belton?
Well, actually, it would be...
Okay,
Dr.
Melton. Okay, very good. So the board is comfortable with this, you have the slide deck in your folder. I'm going to suggest that you follow along with the slides rather than us trying to secure permissions through the system for screen sharing, which we tend to lock down just, you know, to ensure that confidential information isn't accidentally displayed. So, board members, is that acceptable to you to follow along on your own copy of the slides?
Yes.
Yes, okay, you're nodding. So it's a yes.
You're very good. Okay, then, Dr. Melton, the floor is yours, and welcome everyone.
Well, good morning. Thank you, Ms. Packinen, and thank you, Ms. Steinar. I am so happy to come before you again today to present with my colleagues an initiative that we believe will enhance clinical training. So again, pleased to introduce you to the director, training director of the consortium, Dr. Elizabeth Cass-Conkel, and the co-director of training, Dr. Marianne Belton. And I'll turn it over to my colleagues to start the presentation.
Thank you, Dr. Melton. So we're really excited to bring this to you today. This is something that within the consortium we've been talking about for several years. And it's as people that are very involved in the training of our future psychologists, we think that there is a real need for to put some guardrails on the folks that are supervising our upcoming, you know, licensed professionals. We are asking for the board's support to make legislative changes to require the training for supervising future psychologists. The situation, I think you guys are relatively aware of. There have been several applicants that have had problematic supervision situations in recent months. I guess we're calling them the rogue supervisors. The applicants have been exploited. We actually have an intern at my site right now who had to completely redo their internship hours due to problems with their supervisor in a previous role, which is just really an unfair situation to those applicants. It also brings up concern for if our applicants aren't having appropriate supervision, how does that affect the public that they are working with? So I think this is, you know, a multi-level problem. How do people become supervisors? Some people choose it and seek it out. And those are not generally the folks that we're trying to reach here. But some people get promoted into the role where, you know, they've been at an agency for a while, somebody leaves, and now all of a sudden you're a supervisor. And I think there's a sort of mindset of like, well, I was supervised, I must know then how to supervise somebody. And we're taking the stance of, it's more than just that. And, you know, there's research, there's frameworks, there's things that supervisors need to know and stay up on top of in order to provide the best supervision to those trainees so that then they are also offering that best service to the public that they are working with. With the consortium, as I mentioned, this has been a topic that we've been bringing up for several years. I'm happy to report that this last year, we have now put in place for our supervisors that are part of the consortium, the affiliated sites, anyone that is working with one of our residents needs to have 6 hours of CEs in supervision every license cycle. And we picked that number to sort of align with what the Board of Behavioral Health Examiners is already utilizing. Many of our supervisors are already clinical supervisors with the BBHE, so they already have those hours in play. But I think for those that don't already have that, it's letting them know that this is something that we think is really important. And I think I'll hand it to Dr. Belton at this point.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. So the recommendation here, as Dr. Capps-Campbell has shared, is to have supervision training as a requirement for the benefit of training students, interns, and postdoctoral residents here in Arizona. We hope to model after the Arizona Board of Behavioral Health Examiners requirements, and also hoping to create a clinical supervisory list of everyone who is part of this process and takes on the supervisory hours. We've also put some considerations here into a grandfathering process. And once we progress in this process, we'll delineate and have more bullet points and kind of fine details about that. But please know that we do have considerations in place for that. When we're thinking about the actions then here that we're requesting from the board, as we mentioned, we're hoping for support. We're also hoping for support from our fellow psychologists, the training community as a whole in Arizona. And then the ultimate goal here would be to have that change in the rule and statutes so that we're able to have supervision be a requirement for psychologists as we're renewing licenses. All right, and I'm going to hand it over to my colleague, Dr. Melton.
All right, so keeping the conversation going and piggybacking off of what Dr. Capps-Campbell and Dr. Belton have shared, we understand and are considering all of the different processes involved in making this change for all supervisors in the state of Arizona. And so developing a communication strategy is really important to us, especially with considering the stakeholders that will be involved. And so I just wanted to go over some of the key messaging pillars around this, and also would appreciate your feedback about these messaging and if there's anything that we can hit harder or need to switch or modify in any way. So, of course, the start is protecting the profession, which will then protect the public, right? So I really want to emphasize that this change is about alignment with APA guidelines for supervision, as well as part of just best practices. And so this is about quality assurance, right? And so the supervising training will highlight that we can ensure the quality of the training aspects, reduce liability, and promote ethical standards. So with that, that's where we see that connection of enhancing the clinical training quality. We're framing this as an opportunity to support excellence in supervision and mentorship and competency development. And in doing so, we're going to share data and really base this on data-driven decisions. So looking at data and anecdotes showing how untrained supervision impacts clinical outcomes and training well-being as well. We're wanting to support our supervisors. So the messaging here is not there's one more thing or that we're wanting to be exclusionary about who can and who can't, but really wanting to position this initiative as a value add, not a burden. So being accessible, having flexible training opportunities is what ASPA will continue to partner with the training consortium to be able to do. So that's with creating CEs, online modules, workshops will be made available. And again, I really want to underscore the accessibility of it, right? And so we'll look at how we are pricing CEs and making things available to folks as we move forward with this requirement. This is also even before, right, we may have a statute change, but really changing the standards as a practice. I remember attending a board meeting many years ago, and Dr. Wexler was on the board, and this line I will never forget, and I use it often. He said, we set the standards to which we aspire. So we don't need to have a law or a statute to begin to really move forward on that. So that's my little soapbox. And then lastly, again, part of this initiative really is about promoting equity and accountability, right? So emphasizing how supervisor training really helps to mitigate bias, power differentials, and harm in supervisory relationships. So some of the board complaints that have come forward more recently that really there's some exploitation or potential for exploitation. We're wanting to decrease that and really do it in a proactive way. And I also have to add this piece. This is also when we're talking about equity and accountability, we are linking this to enhancing the diversity and inclusion within our field and really countering any oppressive goals that are in training environments. And so those are our key messaging pillars, and we will have aligned strategies to be able to do that. And then turning it back over to my colleagues.
Thank you. Okay, so obviously we recognize that we are opening a can of worms and that not everybody will be happy about this request and suggestion. There will be challenges. You know, although we are in the field of change, we know that change is very hard for people. We do really want to be aware of some pitfalls that people are going to see. There can be resistance due to the added requirements. And I want to make it clear we are not suggesting that this requirement go for every psychologist as new CEs, but only for those that want to supervise towards licensure for their supervisees. You know, again, there's that perceived threat to autonomy. How are you telling me what to do and how to do it? And my stance on that is, you know, everything that we've already said. But in addition, if someone's trainee gets into trouble and ends up in front of the board, I know that one of the first questions that you will ask their supervisor is, what have you done in terms of supervisory training? So I think there's those guardrails to sort of put that in place. In terms of access to these trainings, the consortium already provides a lot of this training on an annual basis. We have the annual training conference, which typically is in November. I believe this year it will be in February of 26. We work with ASU counseling and coordinating that. Also at the ASPA conference, I believe there will be a training track this year. Normally we do a pre-conference, but Colleen has changed that for this year. So there are already opportunities built into what's available for that. One of the things that I think is really important that we take into consideration is some level of grandfathering, because we would hate for people to have this hard deadline and then trainees lose hours that they've already earned because their supervisor hasn't had time to get the training and whatnot. And I think that's where our messaging now to get people up to speed ethically will help. But also the issue of those of us that already have that clinical supervisor role with the BBHE, I would prefer not to have to do an additional 6 hours, you know, to have some level of crossover for those of us that are already doing the trainings. I think you guys have the PowerPoint. So I think if we open it up to questions, I'm not sure what the next step of the process is, but we're just really thankful that you gave us time on your agenda to hear what we're hoping to move forward with.
No, I appreciate all of that. Thank you for bringing a proposal like this to us. I know, you know, we have had discussions in previous board meetings on these topics, so this is very timely and much needed. So commend you all for the effort and time you put into this. Ms. Packinen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just by way of sort of orienting the board to the fact that it does not appear there's any statutory authority at this time to require supervisor training. I call your attention to the statute 32-2071. Subsection F prescribes 10 requirements that an internship must comprise, one of which is that the training program has a clearly designated staff psychologist who is responsible for the integrity and quality of the training and who is licensed or certified to practice psychology at the independent level by any licensing jurisdiction of the U.S. or Canada. I would think that if there were to be a requirement to acquire a supervisor training, it would be in that subsection and it's not there. So that will have to be, you know, a consideration that, you know, we have this statutory construct today. It can change certainly, you know, into the future. And so, you know, maybe in an interim basis, this program is marketed and incentivized, but the long game goal is for statutory change. So I just wanted to frame that for the board.
Yeah, I appreciate that, Ms. Packinen, because my question was going to be, you know, is this something that we can do via rule change potentially? And, you know, that answers that question is, you know, probably need a statutory amendment. And we recently did the amendment to the ethics rules regulations that's, I think, going into effect at the end of this month, like May 31st. Mm-hmm. So that was my thinking was, oh, we can maybe just do another amendment to that. But I think that sort of option is foreclosed. So I guess in terms of next steps, Ms. Packinen or Ms. Galvin, is it appropriate for the board to consider sort of authorizing some sort of a legislative change and what that looks like? Is I know it is in the works and we are ironing out some of the details, but is that the next step?
I do believe Dr. Medina's hand is up, but I believe what the panel is requesting today is just the general support from the board with respect to this initiative. And because there's no legislation drafted, you would be supporting the concept of what has been presented.
And Dr. Medina, before we get to you, the question that comes to my mind is if there is going to be a statutory change, one of the things that we might have to think about is out-of-state supervisors and out-of-state applicants who, you know, come in. So, you know, we have had applications from, you know, people who have done their training in, I don't know, like Idaho. And if that supervisor is not trained according to our statutes, then what happens to those applicants? We just have to think through that because we don't want to sort of create an environment where we are closing Arizona's doors to non-Arizonans who want to get licensed. So that's just, you know, wanted to plan that thought in case that, you know, didn't occur to a few people. So Dr. Medina.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to put out there an idea, and I don't
you know, to see what everyone's thoughts are. I know there is, you know, it would need a statutory change to require this, but I thought of having maybe developing a video, just informational video on what our rules, regulations, statutes entail, and maybe down the line, consider putting a question, you know, has the supervisor seen this video? Has the applicant seen this video? Just to spread information, not as a requirement per se, but that might be something to consider to have one place, I mean, aside from this rules, statutes, and things like that, that perhaps we could think of developing in the future.
Ms. Galifian and then Dr. Capps-Conco.
Thank you. I had a question with respect to the grandfathering. Are you seeking to grandfather those supervisors in who are also supervisors at BBHE? Or is the grandfathering applicable to those in psychology who are already supervising, you know, trainees?
Great question. So the grandfathering covers, and again, these are details that need to be figured out. I know that the BBHE just worked through this issue. They made some changes to the LSAC rules. So again, we don't need to reinvent the wheel. We can work with those folks in terms of, hey, what were the pitfalls that you ran into so that we can work through this? The statutes and rules for psychologists are a little bit different than those for the master's level. So I think having access to both of those pieces of information, if you're going to be a clinical supervisor for both, are important. But in terms of the grandfathering, I think it's about making sure that when that hard date hits, that there's either been enough time for the people currently supervising to get that training needed so that those current trainees don't lose the hours that they've worked up to that hard date. And to make sure that moving forward, there's just that envelope of time where people could sort of fall through. And we want to make sure that people that have appropriate training aren't falling through. And to Mr. Dinar's question, I know that the BBHE does have a couple of lines in there about out-of-state supervisors and how they classify what is appropriate and what is not appropriate. So again, I think we don't need to reinvent the wheel. We just need to apply it to our field specifically.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Thank you. There was another hand up, or maybe not. Yes, Dr. Livesey.
Hi. So I had three things I wanted to ask about, and one of them has already been discussed just now about the out-of-state hours, the out-of-state supervision, and how that would look. So I will set that aside. But the other two kind of things I was pondering about during this presentation, which thank you so much for putting this together and coming before us today, because I think it's really important for us to discuss this. I'm wondering if the Board of Behavioral Health Examiners has any like outcomes about how them requiring supervisor training has impacted their number of board complaints or the severity of the board complaints over the years. I know that they've been requiring supervisor training for quite some time now, and maybe we don't have that data, but that'd be interesting to look at. And then also I'm wondering if, and maybe this is like a kind of a more nationwide look, or maybe just within the state of Arizona, I'm wondering, and I'm not suggesting that it does, but does it matter if a supervisor came from an APA site in terms of like, was the training done in an APA site versus a non-APA site? I know that a number of the board complaints that this board has listened to over the last number of years regarding supervisor exploitation or like supervision that didn't quite add up at times has been from non-APA, non-APIC sites, but I'm not saying that just because a site is APA that makes it a perfect training experience, but I'm just anecdotally wondering if those types of things have been looked at as well.
I don't have an answer for you on those numbers, but I think those are great questions.
And if I can answer that second part about the considering of APA or non-APA sites, my initial thoughts are that if someone has obtained their licensure, right, that would be the minimum qualification. So whether they came from APIC, APA, or non-APIC, APA, if they have met the standards for licensure, then that can be kind of our baseline requirement. And then with these other CEs that we require or the training requirements, we can have a little bit more of an opportunity to really focus in on the skill of supervision. So that's my initial thoughts for that.
Dr. Seideman.
Thank you, Mr. Diner. I'm really excited you three are here from ASPA. Welcome. And I'm going to try to keep this short, but here's some thoughts I have. We're obviously speaking to the issue of competence for supervisors, and APA accredited psychology programs require at least one course in consultation and supervision. So to speak to Dr. Melton's comment about the minimum requirements, I think that's going to be important to look at, because there are some programs. Being a licensed psychologist doesn't mean one is competent in doing the skill of clinical supervision. And so I think as we're looking at these grandfathering issues and minimum levels of competency, we should look at, I think, education, training, and experience, because there are a number of people who get a license and then they can be a supervisor. And we know that's perhaps not always effective. So just some thoughts there.
Dr. Stewart.
Thank you, Mr. Dunner. I appreciate the comment thus far. I also agree with Dr. Melton and Michelle. Thank you for being here. This is great. That the minimum would be the license to practice as an independent level in Arizona. And then in addition to that, I think the idea is for 6 credit hours per licensing cycle in supervision. That's a wonderful idea. Others, I'm on the Board of Behavioral Health Examiners list as a supervisor, and I would very much like for those hours to be applicable to supervision for psychologists. A concern I have, I live in a rural area of Arizona. I mean, we have a lot of trees up here, not that many people, but we have a lot of trees and scenic places. What the Board of Behavioral Health Examiners has found is they don't have supervisors for the rural areas, simply because I don't know that it's simply because of the requirement to take the supervision courses, but I have to think that plays into it. What accommodation, if any, are you thinking of in terms of the rural areas and having the number of supervisors available to supervisees, to trainers?
And I'll take that one. I think on the PowerPoint, we do talk about the rural areas and having that availability to participate in these CEs virtually. I know that when I just renewed my BBHE clinical supervisor, I did the 6 hours virtually. It was a couple of ladies that I've seen them in person before, and they now have online website platform where you can access that 6-hour refresher training. But I think that is a consideration, you know, because we want more people to have this competence. So we want to make it as available as possible.
Yeah. And to follow up with that, historically in years past, as you mentioned initially, during the annual conference, AZPA conference, a pre-conference day has frequently been supervision. And that could easily meet the hour requirements there, I would assume, for both the Behavioral Health Board as well as the Psychology Board. Thank you, Mr. Dinar.
Appreciate that. All right, so I guess that there isn't like a motion or an action item other than, you know, just, you know, that people have expressed their support. Yes, Dr. Melton.
If I may make one more comment before we begin to move forward in the conversation and agenda, I just really want to bring forward and thank Dr. Capps-Kunkel and Dr. Belton, and also acknowledge that they are part of the Arizona Psychology Training Consortium, which is a separate entity from ASPA. So I wanted to make sure that I pull them forward in the work they do and the expertise that they bring, especially around training. As you've heard them talk about the changes and the development and the progress they've been making in the consortium to ensure that anyone coming through their program, whether supervisor or trainee, it is top quality. And so I just wanted to make sure that you knew that about the training consortium and all of what they are bringing in. And then ASPA is definitely coming in and supporting and taking their lead on how we can roll this out. So I just wanted to make that clear. So thank you.
Thank you. And thank you all for coming and presenting to us today. This is an important topic and commend you all for the efforts. Okay, so Ms. Pakkinen, can we go to number 7?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Let's do that now.
Okay. So number 7 is discussion, consideration, and possible action relating to initial case review of complaint number 25-15 against Jody Cuneo, PhD. And before I begin, just a reminder that the board may vote to go into executive session for any agenda item according to ARS section 38-431.03, subsection A2, to review confidential records, including the receipt and discussion of information or testimony that is confidential by state or federal law, or ARS section 38-431.03, subsection A3, to receive confidential legal advice from the board's attorney. And I believe, Dr. Seidman, you're the lead, so the floor is yours.
Thank you, Chairman Dinar. This is my summary of complaint number 25-11, opened by the board against Dr. Jody Cuneo. You may recall I summarized this complaint at our March 7th, 2025 board meeting, where the board voted to grant a continuation of the proceedings due to a risk management coverage dispute, and only recently Dr. Cuneo retaining counsel. Dr. Cuneo at that time confirmed that she was not supervising trainees at that time and did not have plans to do so. Dr. Cuneo was issued a license by this board on September 28th of 2017 and is the sole owner and director of Grandis Health, an agency that's provided internship and postdoctoral supervised experiences for psychologist trainees. Dr. Julie Curley, a past applicant for licensure, who graduated from Walden University, completed her internship under Dr. Cuneo on September 12th of 2022. Dr. Curley also completed a postdoctoral training experience under the supervision of Dr. Cuneo, of which the start date has never been verified. At its September 6, 2024 meeting, the board reviewed and approved Dr. Curley's request to withdraw her application for licensure due to the internship under Dr. Cuneo's supervision failing to comply with statutory and rule requirements. On two separate occasions, the Application Review Committee substantially reviewed Dr. Curley's application materials and identified that payment to Dr. Curley from Dr. Cuneo's training was based on trainee-generated service productivity, which is inconsistent with Rule R4-26-209, General Supervision, of which C states, payment between a supervisor and supervisee. One says a supervising psychologist may pay a monetary stipend or fee to a supervisee if the amount paid by the supervisor is not based on the supervisee's productivity or revenue generated by the supervisee. The internship written training plan that was submitted by Dr. Curley for Dr. Curley's internship under Dr. Cuneo's supervision stated reimbursement and compensation. Number one, the intern will be compensated for the client contact hours only, and administrative and or report writing times are not covered in this manner. The default compensation rate is $65 per session, but should the intern make an arrangement to work on a sliding fee scale with the client, should the intern make an arrangement to work on a sliding scale with the client, this rate supersedes the default rate. The sliding scale rate would be the entirety of compensation for those sessions. At the July 26, 2024 Application Review Committee meeting, Dr. Cuneo stated, quote, trainee pay structured was not a standard flat stipend, but was going to vary by the amount of client contact hours, unquote. Both Dr. Curley and Dr. Cuneo were present at the August 2nd, 2024 board meeting. Dr. Cuneo stated to the board that Grandis Health trainees were not compensated based on hours worked, direct client contact hours, or productivity. The board requested that Dr. Cuneo submit copies of pay stubs, timesheets, and any other documentation that reflected the compensation arrangement during Dr. Curley's training experience. At the August 30th, 2024 Application Review Committee meeting, Dr. Curley was present and stated she was paid for each hour she was with a client and that she was not compensated for the hours during which Dr. Cuneo provided supervision. Dr. Curley confirmed pay stubs were never issued to her and that she wasn't always paid on time. Other interns had the same, and also that other interns had the same experience. At this meeting, Dr. Curley read a text message sent by Dr. Cuneo that stated, quote, if the checks go through, then yes, I can pay you. During the application review process, Dr. Cuneo had submitted seven different versions of Dr. Curley's internship verification forms that included different start and end dates and completed hours. Dr. Cuneo also reported to the board staff that question, did the psychology training program have at least two psychologists on staff as supervisors? Dr. Cuneo answered yes. On September 13th, 2024, Dr. Cuneo reported to board staff that she was notified by the field placement coordinator at Walden University that a current intern was being, quote, removed from internship placement at Grandis Health given the board's investigation. By the way, I apologize for the length of this, but this has been an ongoing process. So there are other concerns to consider as well. Over the course of time, Dr. Cuneo has reported to board staff that there were no other contracted psychologists with Grandis Health who would have provided supervisory experiences at any point with any interns. Any secondary or outside supervisor would have separate contracts between the interns, those potential supervisors, and their schools. However, Dr. Curley's records noted a number of internship hours were required under the supervision of a psychologist, Dr. Benjamin Bushman. On the internship verification forms Dr. Cuneo submitted in support of Dr. Curley's application, she answered, quote, yes to this question. Did the psychology training program have at least two psychologists on staff as supervisors? At another time, Dr. Cuneo also stated, Dr. Benjamin Bushman is not an employee or contractor associated with Grandis Health. Board staff had contacted Dr. Bushman to obtain clarity relative to his role with Dr. Curley's internship and was asked, was there a formal or informal agreement between you and Dr. Cuneo specific to providing internship supervision of Dr. Curley? Dr. Bushman answered, yes, an informal agreement could be available if needed. At least two of Dr. Cuneo's former interns attended the January 22nd, 2025 complaint screening committee meeting, one of which at least was removed from their internship program in September by Walden University. In response to questions posed by the complaint screening committee, Dr. Cuneo incorrectly asserted that they would be able to use the hours accrued at Grandis when applying for licensure in the future. This former intern emailed board staff and noted they had logged over 1,000 hours with no pay, compensation, or stipend, and lost all of those hours. In considering all of these items, the board may consider if there's evidence of the following professional conduct violations. ARS 32-2061-16C, making or using statements of a character tending to deceive or mislead. ARS 32-2061-16J, making a fraudulent or untrue statement to the board or its investigator, staff, or consultants. ARS 32-2061-16M, using fraud, misrepresentation, or deception to obtain or attempt to obtain a psychology license or to pass or attempt to pass a psychology license or in assisting another person to do so. ARS 32-2061-16Y, exploiting a client or patient, student, or a supervisee. ARS 32-2061-16DD, violating an ethical standard adopted by the board as it pertains to the following sections of the APA's Ethical Code for Psychologists. 2.03, maintaining competence. 3.08, exploitative relationships. 7.01, design of education and training programs. And 7.02, description of education and training programs. This concludes my summary of this matter.
Thank you, Dr. Seidman. Any questions for Dr. Seidman at this time? Hearing none, this was a complaint opened by the board, so there is no complainant. And I see Dr. Cuneo, you are present here with Mr. Beardsley. Thank you both for being here. You may wish to make a statement, and then I'm sure we'll have questions.
So first, thank you for the opportunity to speak today. I appear before you with deep respect for this board, the entire investigatory process, and the standards of the profession. Let me begin by acknowledging that mistakes were made in my supervisory program at Grandis Health, most significantly the compensation structure that I implemented, and that would be tying the payment to direct client contact hours. That was not compliant with the Arizona Administrative Code nor ethical guidance on the subject. At the time, I believed that I was following an accepted model. In fact, the payment clause used in Grandis's written training plan was drawn directly from a training manual template that was provided to me by Walden University as part of my credentialing process with them. I incorporated that without fully anticipating or appreciating that it conflicted with Arizona regulations. That was my oversight, and I take full responsibility for that. To be clear, it was never my intention to create a system that encouraged overwork or exploitation. It was quite the opposite, actually. I was trying to find a practical way to compensate trainees fairly for a broad range of responsibilities that they took on, clinical sessions, documentation, supervision, et cetera. But I now understand that using client contact hours as a proxy, even with the best intention, introduced risk. And for that, I am truly sorry. I also acknowledge the difficulty that the board has had in reviewing the financial records related to Dr. Crowley's payments. I regret that I cannot provide a fully reconstructed payment history. The records are scattered across multiple personal and business accounts, and despite my best efforts, including multiple trips to the bank to request records and tax record reviews, et cetera, there are still gaps. But that being said, I've provided everything I could put my hands on. The risk of exploitation inherent in my stipulation scheme for trainees is not lost on me, but I must convey my sincere belief that my training program at its core was deeply committed to and successful in the professional development and ethical formation of the trainees. I worked very hard to create a rigorous supportive environment for trainees at Grandis Health, and I took many months preparing to do so before taking trainees into the program. These efforts included numerous opportunities for education, demands on my time, and things that weren't captured in compensation. While I had the trainees, I organized ECCC study groups, created out-of-office learning opportunities. We went to conferences and mentored my interns personally through every stage of their training, including court preparation, forensic report writing, and client care with like varied and complex populations. I kept a financially unviable office open in Casa Grande for months, solely so that Dr. Curley could complete her hours there without commuting hardship that would have added hours onto her schedule every day. And that decision came at personal cost, but I did it without hesitation because I wanted to help support the trainees in their program. I never received complaints from my interns regarding their pay or supervision. This was not brought up to me at the time. And I did not coerce or mislead anyone. I treated each trainee with care and respect. And I hope to instill that in them as well. I was going for the same passion for ethical, client-centered practice that has guided me throughout my career, and what I learned from my mentors and my supervisors. I'd like to address two notes, actually. One is the basis for the assertion that Dr. Alafa was unable to use his hours accrued during his internship with me. And the reason that I believe that those hours were going to be used by the university and allowed was because he had contacted me after he left the internship with me, asking for a postdoctoral reference. And that was done very soon after his internship ended with me. And so I had the understanding that his hours were going to be used and that he would be moving forward to a postdoc imminently. When this whole thing happened with the board, I immediately cut off contact with the interns. Sometimes interns would contact me for things and I would say, look, I'll answer this, you know, specific question if it was related to the office, but I cut off all contact with any of the interns because these proceedings were open and I didn't want to have anything that would look like influence in one direction or the other with any of the interns in case anyone was called in for this matter. The practica or the way that Dr. Alafa had started in the office was in a manner where he wouldn't have been paid for the first few hours. It was just finishing up practicum hours, and I don't pay for practicum hours as opposed to paying for internship hours. There was never then an established pay schedule for when he was going to be paid. And now, unfortunately, I don't have contact with him. So I would be seeking board guidance on how to rectify those hours that he does not have paid and what structure should be used so that it is a stipend and I don't fall under the same issue that we're having now of trying to address, you know, how someone is paid and any mistakes that I've made in the past. I understand that the intent that I had going into all of this doesn't erase impact. And I understand that the compensation model I use has given rise to concern, regardless of how it functioned in practice. I've since discontinued all training activities. I don't intend to going back to having interns. If I ever did, I would ensure full compliance with every applicable rule and ethical standard and would actually look forward to the guidance that these added statutes might add to training. In closing, I ask the board to view this matter in its full context. So not as viewing me as a case of exploitation, but as an imperfect but committed educator, hopefully mentor, who made administrative missteps while honestly trying to build something meaningful. And I accept responsibility for all of this and remain committed to learning from this experience and seeking guidance on how to go forward. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you, Dr. Cuneo. Board members, any questions for Dr. Cuneo at this time? Dr. Medina?
Thank you, Mr. Diner. Thank you for being here, Dr. Cuno and Mr. Beardsley. I do have a question in regards to a statement, Dr. Cuno, that you just made about the letter of reference that this trainee asked for you for a postdoctoral experience. So you mentioned that the first few hours were not paid because of a practicum, that you don't pay for practicum, which is customary in the profession. But then when did he start his internship? Did he ask for that letter as a practicum supervisor? If he was with you, how would he start a postdoc if he had not completed internship? So was he doing his internship with you? It just seems very confusing. And I'm wondering if you can sort of clarify that relationship.
Sorry, yes, that's actually two separate things. One was the, if someone had ever started with me before, say, official paperwork went through, or if it was due to a practicum, I really didn't like doing things like that because then you have that weird in-between time of when did dates start, when didn't dates start. But there was never a pay rate or a pay schedule. I'm sorry, rate was discussed. The pay schedule for the internship was never discussed with Dr. Alafa, and that it honestly was never established. And so that would be why there's hours that aren't paid. The issue with me thinking that that there was a problem with, I'm sorry, I'll go back. I will present logically. So Raul had started, Dr. Alafa, sorry, had started. And I, again, as you were saying, we don't pay for practicum. Because there are cases established, somebody's already in the office, we try and just flow straight in. I've done it before. So you just flow straight from your practicum into your internship, if that's going to be allowed, if it gets approved. And so that's what we did. But now there is a pay rate and a pay schedule introduced. He then performed, I believe, 3/4 of his internship with Grandis Health. And then when everything started with the board, the university contacted me and had him for that day pulled out of his internship. There was never a chance for either one of us to address anything. I got all his cases covered. I actually, because I didn't have other interns at the time, I took everything on. I made sure that everyone was covered and cut off contact with all of the interns at that time. And that would be anyone who I would have had contact with in the past, because again, I didn't want anything to look like undue influence in here of me ever being said anything like, look, this is what we're, please word anything this way or anything nefarious like that at all. So at the risk of that happening. Then I received a text message from Dr. Alafa asking if he could receive a reference for his postdoc. And I said, yes, of course, but you're probably going to want to wait until after everything is done with the board so that there's no confusion, anything like that. And that led me to believe that he was going into a postdoc. This was, I don't have the date available, unfortunately, but this was imminently after he had been pulled from my internship. So what it appeared to me to be was that he was just going to complete his final quarter and go directly into a postdoc. And that's why I believed that his hours were being counted by the university.
So, okay. He completed 3/4 of his internship with you?
He completed a significant number. I mean, a very significant number of hours.
So there was, he completed 3/4 of internship and there was no internship agreement? Is that what you're saying?
There was an internship agreement through Walden University. Yes. We did. I would not start hours unless somebody had the agreement in place. The agreement, however, does not have the payment schedule. It has a payment rate. So there are hours owed to Dr. Alafa. There is payment owed to him now. But because I have not had contact with anyone because of the board, I'd be looking for guidance on what because we're having a problem with my pay structure that I had been using for, how should I be paying him now? When should I be paying him now? Should I be making contact with him? Because I have not had contact with anyone, specifically trying to avoid any issues that may arise in the middle while the board hearings are still going on.
Thank you. No further questions at this time.
Dr. Seidemann.
Thank you, Mr. Diner. Good morning, Dr. Cuneo. Good morning, Mr. Beardsley. So in listening to you, Dr. Cuneo, it's you're giving the impression again that there's a lot of role confusion and unclear expectations. I don't understand this practicum, an internship transition. I'm thinking about those 7 iterations of the internship verification form that you had submitted for Dr. Curley. And this is another reflection of, I don't know if it's disorganization or poor documentation. I don't know. The other thing I wanted to speak to is, I believe you had the best of intentions for these trainees. There are a number of them. They need a pre-doctoral internship. They need postdoctoral training to get licensed, and you were trying to accommodate them. With that said, best intentions are great. There's an inherent power differential between a supervisor and supervisees, and you said you hadn't heard anything from other interns, and that's because they're afraid of the power differential, and that's a big issue. And I'm really glad we spoke earlier about training for supervisors, because that needs to be very clear in a supervisee's mind when they're working with trainees. So a trainee is not likely to speak up and say, hey, I feel I'm being mistreated. I guess what I'm asking you to do is reflect on this. And, you continue to have role confusion with this trainee that you had that was a practicum student and I think was a practicum student and now was an intern and collected 1,000 hours. And I would find it hard to believe that that's perhaps how you were trained when you were coming up.
Are you asking me? May my client respond to that, Dr. Seidemann?
Yes, yeah, Dr. Cuneo, please.
Yes, so to not, again, I think this is all in the clarification and the documentation. And again, that is on my end. This is not, onus is on me for this one. I'm fully aware of that. There was not a blending. There would be an absolute end time and an absolute start date from practicum to internship, which is how I was trained to. The practicum is, it's different responsibilities. It's different activities that the interns are involved in. And so there is a big distinction between those two. And it was that, there was the practicum time and then changing over into the internship time. And there's different paperwork associated with it, with the university. And so there are clear dates for when one mode of training ended and then the next mode of training started.
Dr. Cuneo, can you understand what I'm trying to highlight? Based on history, you submitted 7 times for one trainee. And now you're asking about you're talking about kind of a loosey-goosey transition from practicum to internship.
Well, and I'm hoping that the issues that we had with the Meditrek program and with the other interns application were explained for each incidents that occurred with that, and the how the number got quite so out of control and high for that specific application.
Well, not only the number, but the start and end date. We still don't have a start date for Dr. Curley's, I think it was her postdoc. It was one of her training experiences with you.
I would have to look at that because I'm pretty sure with the university there had to be an end date and that it would have had to be placed on her application, which again, we're seeing now is not our source to go to for what the actual end dates were. But I would have to look and see what was in with the university and what was in with Meditrek for when those, when that absolute end date was for her internship. Again, one mode of training into another mode of training, but I would have to look that up. Yes.
Excuse me. I don't expect you to know this by heart. I said the start date, not the end date.
No, that yes. And that's the start date of her postdoc would have been immediately following her internship. I didn't put for any of the practicum students, interns or postdocs, we did not have, say, 2 to 3 weeks of gaps in between things, in between moving in between these modes of training, because there was just going to be no interruption. We were able to plan things in advance for when does the school need the paperwork in by. Okay, let's do that a little early so that you can start things. And, you know, in the postdoc, a school wouldn't be involved, but it was, we had plans in place so that there was a smooth transition. It wasn't a muddled transmission on let me finish up some of my postdoc hours, but I'm also going to start my internship hours. And then there were definite beginning and end dates on those.
I can appreciate that. And that's a good plan. Just the documentation that was submitted was confusing and not clear and not definitive.
Yes. And I unfortunately, I think this is also tied to how when we were discussing my payment history and how I was able to not attain all of the records that were needed, and that it was just typos and sloppiness on my part and not the actual training that was provided.
Thank you. That's all I have for now.
Thank you. Dr. Cunha, just a few questions before I go to my colleagues. So you mentioned that there's the Walden University contract that you used for the training contract with the trainees. Could you speak to that? How many times have you used that contract? Is that the only contract that you have ever used with trainees and so forth?
It is not. It's the only one that has been used at PhD level. I have had a master's level intern who was attending a different university, and I used their template for their contract. The training manual remained the same. There was obviously different compensation. It was a master's level internship. But I'm going to say that there were at least 5 times that I used the Walden contract and that I had students that were associated with Walden. I believe the number is 5.
Okay. And then my next question is, so would you describe sort of your practice as a solo practice? I mean, I use a terminology because I'm a lawyer. So, I mean, we usually have like solo practices as lawyers sometimes. So would you describe it as solo practice, or are you associated with somebody in sort of like a firm setting?
No, that would be a solo practice, which has... Actually, it is closed, but that would have been a solo practice.
Okay. And I mentioned that because oftentimes there is, you know, having a solo practice is hard, right? You have to not just take care of the substantive aspects of the work that, you know, you enjoy doing, but there's also all of the administrative side of things. You have to, you know, keep records, do the billing, you know, do everything that keeps a business functioning as a business. And I just wanted to mention, you know, maybe this is a comment you can react to, but you know, having that sort of, you know, running a business plus also practicing is hard. And, you know, usually I've seen it benefits solo practitioners when they get help, they talk to their colleagues, they, you know, they ask around, hey, you know, how do I do this? Or, you know, look for resources that will aid, have, you know, setting up systems and structures that avoids all of these pitfalls or, you know, tripping on some regulation here and there. So could you reflect to that and like what steps have you taken over the years? I mean, of course, now you realize the gravity of the situation, but before all of this came up, what were some of the steps that you took to understand how to set up a business, how to set up yourself for success?
Looking at, first it would be just doing solo practice, not taking any interns in at all, because you were, as you were saying, I needed to feel that at least the office was stable before adding other people in and not inviting anyone into the beginnings of a business, because that took time to establish. Once it got to the point of having two offices of my own and using someone else's office space and feeling stable enough with just consults with colleagues, there was never anything official going on, and business owners. Speaking with a lawyer at the beginning, you know, when I was opening the practice, just to have all of that paperwork done exactly correctly. and then after several years, coming in contact with someone who had suggested, you know, would I take on an intern? And I thought, yes, and I would. So I took on, there was one intern, and then it turned into a series of interns. Before those interns were taken in, actually, was, I'm going to say it was about 10 months, I think it was 10 or 11 months of my going through and attaining different training manuals from different organizations, including training manuals that I had had in the past, contacting colleagues to find out what their training manuals were, going through Arizona statutes, going through APA regulations, and trying to make sure that everything was covered before signing any paperwork and getting the first intern to come into Grandis Health.
Thank you. Dr. Medina?
Thank you, Mr. Diner. You know, Dr. Acuna, I am a little perplexed when I hear about this practicum and continuing onto internship. A practicum is done for credit hours. It lasts however long the term is in the school. You fill out evaluations. When we fill out evaluations, it's for a specific time period. So when someone asked me for a date, when someone did something, right, whether it's practicum or I'm writing a letter of recommendation, that is information that I need to have. I need to have readily with me. And it's almost like low-hanging fruit, because there is a defined start date and a defined end date. The same happens for internship. There is a defined start date. How can you fill out an evaluation for an intern if you don't have a start date and a midpoint date or an end date? It just doesn't make sense, right? And we received several forms from you that had different dates. The dates that not coincide, it's very difficult to comprehend that. You know, would you fill out an evaluation, the same for like a postdoc, right? Like so let me ask you this. How did you know that if you offered a postdoc, it met requirements for the state of Arizona as a postdoc?
That would be my going through my experience with postdoctoral hours and with just looking at state statutes. And to clarify before we go further and before I forget, I do have, I believe we addressed it in the response. I do have the dates that internships started and ended. And I think the way that we addressed this was some of the mistakes that were in there were just to throw out a random date. Maybe the date was listed with the university as their quarter started, but it started on a Sunday. Meditrek then had their hours listed as starting that Monday, but the person didn't actually come into that office until Thursday to see, you know, to see me or to see their first person. And so there are dates that are unusually close in there. And I think it's when it was pulled from the differing paperwork, but there would never be anything in my paperwork that is showing something significant, like a month off or anything like that, where someone was losing that many hours or trying to over attribute that many hours. It was technically. So do I have dates available? Yes, I don't have dates available to me right here for every intern to speak to all of that. Again, it's been paperwork issues on my end. Yes.
And I think that this answer that Dr. Cunha is providing, she has dates available and maybe not top of mind right now, but she has dates available for when this practicum ended, Dr. Alafa, and when the internship began. She can provide those to the board. I believe she also has the Curley postdoctoral start date, which if it wasn't provided in our response, we'll supplement. She has records, you know, her own records for when those dates started. But she is acknowledging, and really this goes back to one of the comments that was made earlier, the onus for completing those verification forms, the role confusion. She was relying on the trainees to get the draft started. And that's why there were so many typos and errors that went back and forth between those drafts. Ultimately, she recognizes at this point, she should have been drafting those verification forms from top to bottom. And that would have dispelled some of this confusion if she had spent time taking that role on at the start. So, I always bristle. I'm worried that there's confusion here. She's taking ownership of the fact that those verification forms were sloppy. She should have been the lead on completing those and using her own information. She does keep records of when different roles are beginning and ending, though, such as Ms. Dr. Alafa's practicum and internship and Dr. Curley's internship to postdoctoral. But regrettably, that information wasn't presented clearly to the board and she's owning that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Beersley. Dr. Cooney, are you a member of the Arizona Psychological Association?
I am not a member of the Arizona Psychological Association, actually.
Are you a member of the American Psychological Association?
Yes, that I am a member of.
Thank you. No further questions.
Thank you. Dr. Livesey.
Thank you, Mr. Diner, Dr. Cuneo, and Mr. Beardsley. Thank you for being with us this morning. I just have a question and then I need some clarification on something. Is the internship training manual the same as your internship training agreement?
No, that is not. The internship training agreement would have been initiated on the university's end for the student, for whoever was coming in. It needs to align with individual states and with your specific placement, but that's initiated on the university end.
Okay, because I see a document in the applications here titled internship training manual, and it does state like policies and procedures, expectations, and then it's signed by both you and the intern. No, it's signed by both you and the intern. So you're saying that you have a separate training agreement that Walden creates for the purposes of the internship. It's a different document that outlines other things.
It outlines the same things. They're trying to make sure that they're not placing someone in a program that doesn't cover the basics that the university wants. So all of the, there's no conflicts between their requirements and my requirements. I think they do, like, it's a base for each state, but because it's a university, they're covering multiple locations. And so that is generated on their end.
Okay. And then, can you provide additional clarification on Dr. Bushman's role with your program? I see there, you know, sometimes it's indicated that he wasn't affiliated with your program, but other times he was. And I'm wondering if he was under any type of written contract with your program is my first question. Did he ever provide any coverage for supervision? And how was he given access, if he was, to the medical records, the patient records?
Okay, so this hopefully had been addressed. I'll reiterate for you. Dr. Bushman and I do not have a contract back and forth between each other to provide supervision. However, with the university, the students have contracts for their primary and secondary supervisors. And if one of us is listed, if I'm listed as somebody's primary supervisor and they were using Dr. Bushman as a secondary supervisor, they of course needed access to records. They needed to know how to get a hold of me at any time. Those were all provided. I do not believe, and we don't have any documentation anywhere of Dr. Curley or Dr. Olafa receiving supervision time with Dr. Bushman at all. There were no evaluations filled out. There were no approval of hours or anything like that, because he was a secondary supervisor in these cases and it wasn't needed, but he was available, of course, due to any emergencies that might arise or anything that might come up in a, you know, just the role of the secondary supervisor.
Okay, so during the course of having students at your site, there was never a time with any of these students that you were ever out because you were ill or taking a vacation away from the site where you couldn't be reached or had to cancel supervision for any reason at all?
No, not that I remember. No, which was pretty significant if we're talking about not having, the way you're wording is like you never went on vacation. No, there really wasn't any time where I would have been unavailable and that anything was needed. The interns all had my all the contact information, my cell phone numbers, if something was happening, and that they had Dr. Bushman as the backup, including his cell phone numbers and access to everything. But no, during the times, I cannot think of anything that we had documented for.
Okay, so you provided 2 hours of individual supervision every week for each intern you had in your program for the entire duration of their internship with you?
At least, yes. Significant amount of hours that added up, but yes, to make sure that everybody had at least the two, in addition to little, like half hour running to each other in the halls or something like that.
Okay. Thank you.
Dr. Stewart.
Thank you, Mr. Dunner. Dr. Cuneo and Mr. Beardsley, thank you for coming this morning. Dr. Cuneo, I thank you for making the statement that you realize that your intent does not excuse the impact on these trainees and psychology applicant individuals. What impact do you think a failed hours, unusable hours, what impact do you think that has emotionally, financially, time-wise, on the psychology applicants for licensure? What impact do you think it has?
I'm going to say not even on, as you ended with, not even on licensure, that catastrophic. It's at the very least impacting a year of somebody's life. At the very least, that you're saying all of you need to start over at the beginning, that I'm wondering if they're questioning the training that they received and whether what they received was accurate guidance during that time. And so that actually is the psychological impact. Obviously, there is the hours, there's the financial, the time lost, having to go through and not just hand in your application and have it approved, that there's fighting for it at this point. And trying to have to almost defend themselves. And that is part of my goal, by the way, is trying to see how I can help everyone get through this. But again, I haven't had contact with anyone. And that's, so I don't know actually how everyone has been doing with this specifically, because I didn't want anything convoluted to arise, but I've been taking in the whole, just this one specific process, just this, the incident with me right now has tremendous impact on everyone's training and how they get started in their careers and how confident they are going in.
It was heartbreaking for me, and I think I speak for the entire board. It was heartbreaking to have an applicant have to withdraw their application for licensure because failed hours, unusable hours. That is significant. Thank you, Mr. Dunner.
Thank you. Any more questions for Dr. Cooney? Yeah. Dr. Seidemann?
Thank you, Mr. Diner. I just want to reiterate that Dr. Curley had to withdraw her application for licensure, and that was extremely heartbreaking. And being a board member for about a year and a half or so, and seeing that in my first term, I was just floored by that. And that's not our job. And that's not protecting the public per se. That took a huge hit on a person who put multiple years, energy and effort into a profession that now she doesn't know what to do with. And she even asked us, what do I do now? And we were at a loss. To piggyback on Dr. Livesey's questioning around a secondary supervisor, Dr. Cuneo, when Dr. Bushman was identified as a secondary supervisor at your practice, were clients informed that he would have access to the clinical record?
Yes. And I believe that this was addressed in the our response to, but yes, he, and that would have been done verbally. I'm not sure whether it had been addressed for me in the past. I was actually meeting with clients personally. I would go in, if not their first session when the intern had done the intake, then at least one other session to explain how the supervisory process, you know, worked. They needed to contact a supervisor. How would they do that? And all of the contact information provided. And basically, again, the explanation of the supervisory process that people would have access to their records.
And the clients would have access to you and Dr. Bushman?
Yes. That they were given at least cards, but I know most of the time what we would do, again, because it was in person, was have them enter their phone numbers directly into their phone and, you know, kind of convey the anytime, do not worry about it. You're not bothering me. Please contact me with any issues that you may have.
And that was for you and Dr. Bushman?
That was for Dr. Bushman and I, yes.
Thank you.
Any further questions for Dr. Cuneo? Hearing none, let's go into our discussion and maybe Dr. Seidemann, since you summarized it for us, you want to get it started.
Mr. Chair, if I may just interrupt, I do want to note for the record that Dr. Bushman and Dr. Curley are present today. So before deliberations, if there are any questions for either of them, perhaps this would be the time for board members to ask. Thank you.
What's your pleasure on that, board members? Would we like to hear from Dr. Bushman? Yes, Dr. Stewart.
Thank you, Mr. Dunner. I would certainly like to hear from Dr. Curley in terms of the impact. I think that will be important as we go into further revision of further questioning.
Thank you. And Dr. Curley, thank you for being here. I appreciate you attending today's meeting. So maybe you heard the question, you want to answer that or make a statement, and then maybe there'll be additional questions.
So the question was, how have I been impacted?
Yes.
Confusion is the big one. You know, I went into this as an older student to begin with. I'm already 52. Do I have the energy to redo an internship and postdoc? Not really. Do I feel like I can trust anybody to do it again? Be honest, I'm a little nervous. You know, to Dr. Cuneo's point, I do think she did, you know, I think she did her very best. You know, at the end of the day, yes, the pay structure was not there. She did come through and she did pay. It was extremely stressful, not knowing when I was going to get paid. You know, the beginning of internship was absolutely fabulous. I thought it was, you know, I thought God came through and you know, gave me a great blessing, because everything started off absolutely fantastic. She did open up that practice in Casa Grande. And I believed, wow, this is great. I'm going to have a forever career. You know, I'm going to be able to, you know, join her with the Grandis Health and take over this practice when I'm licensed. Somehow after that, it just fell apart. Pay wasn't coming in, you know, whenever. And it was just, well, I can't give you this right now, but I can give you this. And it became very stressful. My spouse isn't able to work. And it was, you know, getting disconnect notices. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm trying to get through school and I can't pay the bills. And all of a sudden I'm not getting paid. It was a lot of emotional stress trying to just get everything done. And it, the emotional impact, I think, is the worst. And, you know, what am I doing right now? I'm still working at the job I first started when I moved down here, just as a master's level therapist.
Thank you, Dr. Curley. Yeah. If it pleases the chair, I would also like to hear from Dr. Bushman in terms of what he sees as the impact of these failed internship and postdoc hours on the applicants.
For sure. Dr. Bushman, thank you for being here, and you heard the question. And
yes. So thank you to everyone for your careful consideration of all of these important matters. And it is heartbreaking to hear that Dr. Curley has not been able to move on in the time frame that she wanted to, and the different kinds of effects that's had on her and her professional life and personal life going forward. I didn't have a lot to do with Dr. Curley's internship or fellowship. So these matters came into my awareness, you know, after the fact. But certainly the impact is also felt on me and the way that I'm doing business and working with any students or people in the different roles with my practice going forward. So I would just echo that it's a huge shame and very unfortunate situation. I would also like to emphasize I have known Dr. Cuneo for a very long time. I've known her to be a very professional person, very caring person, and I do believe that her intentions were very good despite some of these effects.
Thank you, Dr. Bushman. I have no further inquiry, Mr. Dinar.
Thank you, Dr. Stewart. Board members, any questions for Drs. Curley or Bushman at this time? All right, then, Dr. Seidman, do you want to get us started on the discussion phase of this?
Yes, Mr. Diner. This matter has been going on for a while now, and we've spent a lot of time on it. And I think the board needs to consider if there's enough evidence for violations of professional conduct on those items, the ARS 322061s that I mentioned earlier, and the violations of the ethical codes that I had mentioned earlier as well.
Thank you. And that's a good reminder. This is an initial review, so we are sort of substantiating some of the allegations, and then we'll have other process where we go through. Any other discussion items? I mean, I fully believe Dr. Cunha when she says she understands the gravity of this, and she understands the impact this has had. It was inadvertent, but you know, hindsight can be 20/20 sometimes. And I do appreciate some of the statements that Dr. Cunha made in being contrite and expressing her regret in how some of these things happened. But is there enough to proceed on the allegations that that are on the table? I think yes. Is there any discussion or motion, Dr. Medina?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It is surprising and unfortunate, you know, everything that has transpired. Even hearing about secondary supervisor. A secondary supervisor is someone that is also actively involved in the supervision of our trainees. It's not someone that I have here in the background in case I die, they can take over, you know. And I've heard, no, I wasn't sick. I always was available by phone, even if perhaps Dr. Cunha was out. Like, this is, to me, this is a clear example of operating or doing something outside your bounds of competence. And the word that comes to me is sort of this inbreeding. You know, I went to Walden, I used my documentation the way it was done with me. I did it, Walden did this, and there is no consultation, not going outside of these Dr. Bushman, Dr. Cunha, and Walden. And we'll keep, you know, placing people in documents. We've reviewed documents that have wrong dates, not necessarily, you know, not talking about this case in particular, but it's just mind-boggling. And while I do believe that the intention with these placements was good, I think there was a huge misjudgment, misunderstanding. I don't even know how to classify it, you know, from the get-go. When we ask on a form, is there a second psychologist on staff? And time after time, we hear yes, 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 yes. And then when, you know, Dr. Cunha comes here, says, oh no, it's a solo practice. So there is not a second psychologist on staff. You know, it's a continuous misunderstanding and not knowing. And I, you know, sometimes I am speechless because a secondary supervisor provides additional insight. The goal is not to complete your supervision in this cocoon of this is my only supervisor and this is what I do. This is what I, you know, I want a different viewpoint, different opinion. I want to hear, you know, from a different psychologist. I want to, it's breadth and depth of experience. And, you know, it is concerning when I hear someone
that their practicum, that their internship, that their postdoc, and it's all the same supervisor. And there's this secondary supervisor that apparently has had no contact or minimal contact, doesn't have a way to get records unless, you know, it comes through the owner of the practice. I don't know. I do believe the intentions were good to begin with. I do not think this was done responsibly. And I mean, I do have big, big, big concerns. Thank you.
Dr. Seidman.
Thank you, Mr. Diner. In terms of professional conduct issues, at the very least, I believe that there are clear violations of our APA ethics code of maintaining competence, design of education and training programs, and description of education and training programs, at the very least. I do want to reiterate that with everybody else that intentions are great, and sometimes thinking with the heart over the mind can be dangerous. Thank you.
So I guess at this time, the options would be for a motion for an offer of some sort of a consent agreement. And then Dr. Cuneo might have the option of rejecting that agreement and going for a formal hearing or a formal interview or an informal interview. Ms. Galvin, did I capture that correctly?
You did. The range of motions would be to dismiss, you would find no violations, to refer it for an informal interview, direct the parties, invite the parties to enter into negotiations for a settlement, providing some idea of what the settlement terms would look like. If you believe that this warrants a suspension or revocation, then you could refer the matter to the to a formal hearing.
Thank you. Dr. Stewart.
Thank you, Mr. Dinar. I move that this be referred for informal hearing, and that we construct a letter of understanding and a consent agreement, and the outline in terms of what's to be included must include updating Dr. Cuneo's continuing education training, specifically in supervision. I know that she's indicated to us that she's not supervising anyone now and maybe doesn't have any intent to do this in the near future. But I think, you know, updated training should be done. It's just the impact on Dr. Curley and the other students is just too great to dismiss this case. So there has to be some consequence to this. Thank you.
I'll second that motion for purposes of discussion, but Dr. Stewart, there might be some friendly amendments proposed.
Yes.
Dr. Medina.
I would like to move into executive session to seek legal advice, please.
All right, let's do that. Second for legal advice. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? None opposed. The motion carries. Okay, we are back in open session. It is 10:39 a.m., and I'll exercise my moderator's privilege to ask for a recess. We'll be back at 10:50 a.m. The quorum, so we'll get started. It's 10:50 a.m., and we are back in open session. Code word, please.
Yes, the first continuing education code word is Brooklyn Bridge. Brooklyn Bridge, thank you.
All right, so we are on agenda item number 7. And Dr. Stewart, would you please like to restate your motion?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that we refer this for an informal hearing with the component of having a consent agreement drawn up and presented to Dr. Cuneo and Mr. Beardsley. Some of that would be a term of probation, a term of supervision, as outlined by the board staff.
I'll second that motion. Any discussion?
Just if I may, this is Jean Galvin. How long of a period of probation are you suggesting?
I'm sorry, Ms. Galvin. I meant to say, and I just overlooked it. I recommend a term of 2 years.
And supervision, is that in the form of a practice monitor, or if she provides supervision, do you wish that her license be restricted so she can't provide supervision, or?
I think she needs supervision if she chooses to supervise any trainees or students in the future for that 2-year period.
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead, Ms. Godden.
Is there a continuing education component or any other remedy?
Yes, ma'am. We refer us back to item number 8 and the supervision requirements there, and she must meet the supervision requirements even as outlined by the Board of Behavioral Health Examiners here in Arizona. So, if possible, I would like to just pick that up and place it in the consent agreement.
Thank you.
Dr. Seideman.
Thank you, Mr. Dyer. If it would please the chair, if I may add to that, is that okay to do? So referring to the Board of Behavioral Health Examiner requirements, I would suggest that we have Dr. Cuneo do the 12-hour training that they require, not the 6-hour training. In addition to reviewing our board rules and statutes, our board's rules and statutes involved with NetCE.
I accept that friendly amendment, and yes.
Yeah, I'll second that. Dr. Medina.
Could it be considered not be able to provide any supervision in the first year and the second year if it is, if it's something Dr. Cuneo wants to continue doing, providing supervision, that it must be done under a supervisor, under supervision? Of the supervision that she's providing.
I accept that friendly amendment as well. Thank you.
I'll second that. Dr. Seideman.
Sorry, just to clarify. So that supervisor would be like a practice monitor for the supervision that we're talking about?
Yes.
Okay.
For the supervision, yes.
Correct.
Thank you.
Any other discussion or amendment proposals for Dr. Stewart?
I do have a question. Is degree of concern included here or no?
Sorry, I believe you're referencing a letter of concern.
That's a letter of concern. I'm sorry.
That's
yes.
Typically a non-disciplinary resolution. Oh. I believe I heard you say decree. So I don't know if you're talking about a decree of censure.
That's it. I apologize. The decree of censure.
I accept that friendly amendment.
And a second, and just as a matter of clarification, so this is a disciplinary offer of a disciplinary consent agreement with a decree of censure as a component of that.
Yes, sir.
The 2 years of probation and the no supervision for 1 year, and then if supervision wants to be provided with the monitoring of that supervision, so a supervisor of the supervision that is being provided.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am.
As well. Yeah.
Okay, then there is a motion on the table. Any further discussion? Since it's disciplinary, let's do a roll call, Ms. Poe.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
I'm sorry, Mr. Diner, I believe Dr. Livesay had her hand up.
Oh, sorry, yeah, I didn't see that. It's hidden behind like the frame that you have. I apologize. Yes, Dr. Livesay.
Mr. Diner, thank you. I just have a clarifying question. So if Dr. Cuneo were to choose to start supervising again, let's say 5 years from now, would she still have to have that year of supervision for taking on a new supervisee, or is that just within the 2 years of probation? I just want to clarify that.
Yeah, excellent point. And that would be within the 2 years of probation. If it is a consent agreement, we could add a provision that should she, after 2 years, seek to restart her supervision part of her business, she would have to come back to the board and get permission to do that.
I accept that as a friendly amendment.
Can I second that as well? Okay, so that's the motion. Ms. Poe, roll call, please.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Dinar?
Yes.
Dr. Medina?
Yes.
Dr. Davey?
Yes.
Dr. Seidman?
Yes.
Dr. Stenhoff?
Yes.
Dr. Stewart?
Yes.
Dr. Livesay?
Yes.
Vote is unanimous. Motion carries.
Thank you. All right, so that concludes number 7. Dr. Cuneo and Mr. Beardsley, thank you for being here. And Dr. Curley and Dr. Bushman, thank you for participating as well. We do appreciate your insight.
Thank you to the board. Have a good weekend.
Mr. Chair, can I make an agenda selection suggestion?
Sure, yeah.
Since Dr. Bushman is present also for 15A, can we move to that application matter if Dr. Seidman's ready to present it?
Sure, yeah, I'm seeing a nod. Yeah, so 15A is discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding psychologist applications. And this one is Jennifer Krause, licensure by waiver. There was a fair request. And Dr. Seidman, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Chairman Diner. Just give me one sec, please. Okay. So Dr. Krause submitted an application by waiver. Dr. Krause had passed the ECCC, but was not licensed as a psychologist. Dr. Krause's application for licensure was substantively reviewed at the January 6th, 2025 Application Review Committee meeting, which reflected that over 2,000 predoctoral hours were completed at the non-AP accredited Dr. Bushman and Associates, and that internship was completed in May of 2022. Upon review, the committee noted that the submitted written training plan indicated that, quote, pay is available for client contact hours. Hours spent working on administrative tasks, case management, and other time in the office is not reimbursable, unquote. An arrangement that appears to be based on a supervisee's productivity or revenue generated, which does not meet requirements under AAC R4 26209C1. Dr. Bushman had submitted a, quote, internship compensation agreement, which stated, quote, interns are compensated for their work on an hourly basis determined by the specific type of practice engagement, unquote. It was the consensus of the application review committee to issue an initial fair letter requesting clarification relative to the compensation pay structure, conflicting documentation, and also requested copies of all pay stubs for the period of the internship. At the January 31st, 2025 application review committee meeting, the committee reviewed Dr. Krause's application and the response to the formal additional information request letter. Unfortunately, the response did not provide the clarification sought. The committee thus requested board staff to issue a second fair letter specifically requesting bank statements that reflected the compensation pattern indicated on the invoices that Dr. Krause had submitted in response to the first fair, and or Dr. Bushman's bank statements and or tax records that showed the withdrawals, cash checks, or otherwise clearly demonstrated the record of compensation received while on internship. At its February 28th, 2025 application review committee meeting, Dr. Krause and Dr. Bushman were present and answered questions, and Dr. Krause's application and FAIR 2 responses were reviewed. Because documentation had been submitted the night before the meeting, the ARC forwarded the application to the full board for review at its March 7th, 2025 meeting. The documentation that was submitted were invoices marked as settled and had Dr. Krause's initials. Dr. Bushman stated at the ARC meeting that he didn't have any other records such as pay stubs. At the board's March 7th, 2025 board meeting, it was noted that documentation received made inconsistent representations, and the documentation submitted in response to the first and second formal additional information request letters did not provide the clarification sought. The board noted that the 1099s it received did not match other submitted materials in response to the FAIR seeking definitive documentation that demonstrated compensation met requirements under AAC R4-26209-C1. The board thus moved to issue a third FAIR, reiterating the requirements of the previous two to include evidence that Dr. Krause was compensated for all unbillable hours during internship. The board also moved to accept a request from Dr. Krause to approve the withdrawal of her application if she chose to do so. On April 7th, 2025, Dr. Krause sent a response to the third FAIR, quote, I do not have any further documentation to additionally prove I was paid appropriately for my internship, unquote. Dr. Krause did include an Excel worksheet breaking down their hours on timesheets and a MedTrek log. This concludes my summary of this matter.
Thank you, Dr. Seidemann. So at this time, I see Dr. Krause, you're here. Thank you for being here. You may wish to make a statement, and then we might have some questions.
Oh, I didn't really have a statement prepared. I still stand by the fact that I was paid correctly. I was paid an hourly rate. It was not as clean and as organized as it probably could have been, definitely, looking back, but I never considered I would have to defend it. It worked for us in our agreement. I know that the training plan did say that. As we all know, my secondary supervisor was Dr. Cuneo, and so the training plan kind of came from there. I didn't notice it, I guess, when we submitted it originally, because Dr. Bushman and I had our agreement. I moved across the country for this internship. I was not going to do that on a whim with no guarantee of an income to pay my rent. I don't want to be on the other side of the country homeless for it. But I was paid correctly, albeit a little unorganized. And I do stand by my internship. I wish it was better prepared, more organized.
Any questions for Dr. Krause? Hearing none, maybe we can come back to Dr. Krause, but I believe Dr. Bushman, if you're still here, would you like to speak to this matter as well? All right, well, hearing no response from Dr. Bushman, any questions for Dr. Krause, or do we want to go into executive session?
I'm sorry, I had a technical issue and couldn't unmute the button.
No worries.
I would like to just say Dr. Krause has been an exceptional intern. She clearly is very bright. She has passed all the requirements as far as ECCC and awareness of, state and national ethics. In every way, she's a great candidate for licensure. As far as the payment documentation, we've already explained that in detail, how that happened. Unfortunately, as she said, some of that documentation is not clear, but she was paid in accordance with recommendations from the board and the statutes of not being tied to hourly generating money from the clients. So I just hope that you will be very thoughtful about Dr. Krause. Again, we talked about impact. It would be a shame if, for no other reason than suspicions and an unfortunate lack of some documentation, that she be denied licensure. She definitely deserves to be licensed here and would be an asset to the profession of psychology in Arizona and anywhere else she might choose to practice. We are aware that there have been some shortcomings and have already taken some actions to rectify that if and when those might come into play in the future.
Appreciate that, Dr. Krause, Dr. Bushman. Any questions for Dr. Bushman? Okay, hearing none, Dr. Krause, I have a question or two for you. So I appreciate you responding to the third FAIR request. And I'm seeing the spreadsheet that you built showing the hours worked and the payment. So at this time, am I reading this correctly that we can account basically for 1,342 hours?
Sorry, 1,342 hours?
Yeah. Or like what's the number of hours that we can account for where you were paid hourly?
The ones that I can account for, I have to pull up that information. I'm sorry. I want to say it is 1,800 and some hours that I can account for based on the pay provided.
Okay, so 1,800 something. Okay.
Yes, hold on. Yes, sorry.
Dr. Medina? You're muted.
Of course, it wouldn't be a meeting if that didn't happen. I want to move into propose a motion to move into executive session for legal advice.
Second by Dr. Stewart. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? None opposed. The motion carries. Okay, we are back in open session. It's 11:36 a.m. and we are on agenda item 15A relating to Dr. Jennifer Krause. Any questions for Dr. Krause? Any motion? Dr. Stewart.
Thank you. If the chair would entertain a motion. I move that we grant Dr. Krause a license as a psychologist and that we also issue a letter of concern regarding unprofessional conduct.
I'll second that, and unprofessional conduct relating to 16BB,
yeah, I believe. Yes, sir.
And that's about failing to provide information to the board when right. asked for.
Right.
Ms. Galvin?
Would the issuance of the license be contingent upon her signing a consent agreement for the letter of concern?
I like that. Yes, ma'am. I like that.
I'll second it. I see Dr. Curley's hand up, and I want to allow Dr. Curley to speak just because, you know, these cases are related, if Ms. Galvin doesn't object.
I would prefer that the board conclude its action on this matter before we hear from Dr. Curley.
Okay. Okay, Dr. Curley, just hang tight. We'll complete this and we'll get back to you.
Thank you.
Okay, so in terms of discussion, I think, I mean, the issue that tips me in favor of granting licensure is that we asked for requests for information from Dr. Krause, and she was forthcoming with information. To the extent she could provide us with information, she did provide us with information. I don't think there was any intent to hide information from the board. Now, the information that we don't have just makes practical sense why we don't have that information. So, for example, when Dr. Krause was paid in cash, I don't expect anybody to deposit that cash in a bank account. So a bank statement is not going to show the cash receipts. The cash is going, you know, for groceries, it's going for bills. It's not going into the bank account. So I believe Dr. Krause was truthful when she signed the application, saying everything in the application is truthful to the extent I can provide full and complete truthful information. So I do believe that Dr. Krause was truthful. Now the concern, the wider concern is, do we as a board signal to the larger applicant community that you can get away with not providing information to the board? I'm frankly conflicted on that. I think this case doesn't really give me cause for that type of a concern. In a future case, maybe there is an applicant who is actively trying to hide information from us, and I would be more convinced in those situations to have a letter of concern component to this. But that's just my, again, personal views. I just have one vote on the board. So I would be in favor of just granting unconditional licensure, but I don't believe that the letter of concern component is disciplinary. It's obviously not. It's just a way to signal to the future applicants that, please, you know, take care of this. It's a way to signal to supervisors that they should not be engaging in these types of practices, paying cash, paying through insurance cards, or, you know, whatever the alternative payment methods might be. So as a signaling function, I tend to agree that there needs to be some signal that needs to be sent. And, you know, this case just happens to be in the right place at the right time, or wrong place at the wrong time. So just my two cents. Thank you. Dr. Seidemann.
Here's my one and a half cents. Dr. Krause, thanks for being here today. I know you've been diligent in this, and I appreciate that. I think a letter of concern is extremely important, and it shows the public that a trainee and a supervisor are a collaborative team. Even though there's a power differential, they're a collaborative team that need to be on the same page. And payment is extremely important to a trainee. They have to put food on the table and pay their mortgage. And while working 40 hours under supervision and providing good services to clients. And I think it's extremely important for anybody in the audience today, either as a supervisor or a supervisee, to take this as a learning lesson that documentation of all supervision activities, including payment, is extremely important. Thank you.
Dr. Stewart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I absolutely agree with Dr. Seidman. I think it is important to send that message to the public and the folks in attendance here that are trainees in postdoc or even internships. I'd also like to take a moment. I agree with Dr. Medina and the caution that this case presents. And I just personally believe that we can address that through that letter of concern. I hope that that's sufficient. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Okay. It's non-disciplinary, but let's do a roll call, Ms. Poe.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Dinar?
Yes.
Dr. Medina?
Yes.
Dr. Davey?
Yes.
Dr. Seidman?
Yes.
Dr. Stenhoff?
Yes.
Dr. Stewart?
Yes.
Dr. Livesay?
Yes.
Vote is unanimous. Motion carries.
Thank you, Dr. Krause. Congratulations. You are licensed. If you have any questions, I'm sure staff will be happy to answer that. And Dr. Bushman, thank you for your insights as well. Okay, so that concludes 15A. Dr. Curley, coming back to you, and you had something to say.
Yeah, I guess I'm wondering, since the pay structure between Dr. Bushman and Dr. Cuneo is the same, and myself and the other interns that were under Dr. Cuneo and Dr. Bushman were declined licensure, now that Dr. Krause has gone through, are we going to be able to go through?
You know, that's a fair question, but we can't really answer it right now. But, you know, maybe reach out to staff and they might be able to give you more insights on this.
Mr. Dinar, that is my recommendation, that she can reach out to Heidi. And there are nuances between the cases that may not be evident to an applicant or the respondent that the board has to take into consideration when rendering the decisions.
I guess I'm just kind of dumbfounded as to Dr. Cuneo gets a slap on the hand for exploitation, and there's the discrepancies or the consistencies in pay structure between Dr. Bushman and Dr. Cuneo, and yet one of us gets through, but the other five of us have to redo internship. I don't understand.
And that is something that the staff and I would be happy to discuss with you offline next week.
Great. Could you email me a time where we could set that up?
Yes, Heidi will.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, this is Ms. Poe. I'm going to give the next CE code word. The next CE code word is Golden Gate. Golden Gate. Thank you.
All right. So Ms. Pakkanen, is there like a 30-minute-ish thing? Because I would like to take a break, like a lunch break type, 15-minute break afterward.
Mr. Chair, I think the board can easily review both 9A and B in 30 minutes.
Okay.
Is that a challenge for board staff to get that reviewed? I mean,
we can get it in less than 30,
I think I'll take a swing at that. So let's, if it pleases the chair, discussion, consideration, possible action regarding the Committee on Behavior Analyst recommendations for the following matter. I'll kick off with 9A, and then we'll follow with Dr. Stenhoff on 9B.
Sure.
All right. 9A has to do, and you guys have it in your packets, has to do with a behavior analyst who is licensed in the state, came to us after deciding that she was going to be departing her agency. To kind of cut to the chase, that got accelerated. The applicant or the licensee did several things right in terms of the departure, but then also the committee found that there were just some several errors with regard to transition of clients, some issues around how communication was dealt with during this kind of period of I plan on leaving to when her actual departure left. And because of that, the committee landed on a non-disciplinary letter of concern with an order of continuing education, 9 CEUs around transition planning, consulting with other professionals, and clinical documentation. And that aligns with several of our BACB ethics codes. Typical when we provide CEUs as remediation, those CEUs will not be allowed to be used for her future renewal. And so I make the motion now that the board accept the committee's recommendation.
Second.
So motion and a second, and just as a reminder, the recommendation is non-disciplinary
letter of concern. Yep, non-disciplinary letter of concern and CEs.
All right, any discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? None opposed. The motion carries. Thank you. 9B, Dr. Stenhoff.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So this is complaint number 25-26 for Sarah Kelly. She was issued her BA license in 2020, has been working with an agency since May of 2024. There was a complaint that alleged that an RBT had mistreated a client and that attempted to force the client to perform certain tasks and that Ms. Kelly did not immediately intervene. She attempted to downplay the situation. There appeared to be a lack of accountability by Ms. Kelly. No formal investigation took place. The client has regressed as a result of the incident and has exhibited self-harming behaviors. Ms. Kelly responded to the complaint with over 200 pages of documentation describing the situation to clinic and the clinical notes. Based on the CBA's review of the file and the questioning at the committee meeting, the committee unanimously voted to recommend to the board that the complaint be dismissed due to it didn't rise to a statutory violation. That ends my summary of it. And I'd like to make a motion at this time as well to dismiss the complaint as recommended by the Committee on Behavior Analysts, number 25-26.
Second.
Second by Dr. Stewart. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? None opposed. The motion carries. Ms. Packman, can we do the applications?
Oh, I was going to say, Mr. Chair, if it pleased you, we could continue on with 10. I believe that those are straight to the point as well.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Let's do 10.
If it pleases you, then I will discussion, consideration, possible action regarding the Committee on Behavior Analyst recommendation to open complaints against the following licensees. I'll begin with Rachel Vargas, and then Dr. Stenhoff will continue with David Kelton. In terms of Ms. Vargas, during the course of a discussion with Ms. Vargas, where she had self-reported an issue essentially had failures around supervision, and she made that disclosure to the BACB. She then brought the BACB's notice of violation and outcomes back to this committee to inform us of of those shortcomings in terms of supervision. During the course of the discussion with the CBA, just a few things did not quite sit right. One was the job title that the licensee held during her, or the licensee held prior to being licensed, which was that of a supervising BCBA. Then we had some contradictory comments around whether or not she was actually supervising prior to having a license, or who was supervising her. And so the situation just got quite convoluted, and the committee would like to go ahead and request that the board approve its recommendation to open up a complaint against Rachel Vargas so that they could probe this matter of her supervision, maybe prior to or during licensure. And I will make that my motion.
I second.
Mr. Chair, I do know that the licensee and her attorney are here, and it's my understanding they wanted to address the board with brief comments. So it'd be up to you if you would permit that at this time.
I mean, I appreciate them being here, obviously, but I think this is just an opening of the complaint that just kickstarts the process. So I'm comfortable with not allowing time for statements at this time. So there is a motion on the table. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? None opposed. The motion carries. All right, 10B, Dr. Stenhouse.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So on March 31st of 2025, the Committee on Behavior Analysts reviewed an application for Marissa Beck. Her file reflected that from December 1st of 2023 to May 27th of 2024, she received about 746 hours of supervision. A supervisor experienced well in Arizona from David Kelton. Mr. Kelton's Arizona license was not granted until May 3rd of 2024. So the majority of that 746 hours that was acquired by Ms. Beck while under Mr. Kelton's supervision was disqualified by the committee for purposes of meeting the required 1,500 hours. So based on that, and through the vetting of Ms. Beck's file, we noted that Mr. Kelton was possibly practicing without a license. And so the committee is requesting permission from the board to open a complaint based on the ARS 32-2091-12, reflecting the class two misdemeanor for a person who's not licensed pursuant to this article to engage in the practice of behavior analysis. This ends my summary, but I'm also making a motion that that we open a complaint to investigate this matter further.
Second.
Second by Dr. Stewart. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
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 None opposed. The motion carries.
Mr. Chair, maybe 15B and C finish the applications.
Perfect. Yeah. So 15B would be Talia Davis, Psi D, EPPP.
I'm recused.
Yeah. Thank you, Dr. Medina. Dr. Stenhouse?
I'm recused as well.
Oh, maybe we don't have quorum then, Dr. Okay. Dr. Livesay is recused. Dr. Medina is recused. So that leaves us five.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. Yeah. We won't be able to hear this application.
And who's recused? Dr. Livesay and who? Medina.
Mm-hmm. I was her primary supervisor.
So is this a matter where perhaps you could abstain and not participate and not vote? And Dr. Livesay, is that something, if you abstain, we can still count you for quorum?
Okay. She was just in my internship training program here.
I'll abstain.
Okay. I'll abstain as well.
Okay, thank you.
Dr. Stenhouse? You're muted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to note that I was her professor for several classes while she was working on her master's in applied behavior analysis. But I feel that I can review this case without with objectivity. I mean,
okay. All right. Thank you.
All right, Dr. Seidman, take it away.
Well, everybody will have to hear my summary once again, so sorry about that. Dr. Davis earned a PsyD in clinical psychology from the APA-accredited Midwestern University, which was conferred on 9-6 of 2024. Dr. Davis submitted 2,000 predoctoral internship hours completed at the APA-accredited Southwest Behavioral and Health Services, which was completed in September 6th of 2024. Dr. Davis's references appear to be in order. Dr. Davis responded no to all the declaration questions and answered yes to all of the attestation items. Dr. Davis submitted evidence of a valid fingerprint clearance card. Dr. Davis also had a National Practitioner Databank self-query, which was processed on February 4th of 2025, which revealed no reports. This application appears in order, and if it pleases the chair, I'd like to make a motion to approve this application for examination only.
Dr. Stanhoff seconds. Is it preferable, Ms. Galvin, if somebody else seconds, or?
I had Stenhouse. So Medina and Livesay would not second.
Yeah. Okay. Would Dr. Stenhouse second? All any discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
None opposed. Two abstentions. Mm-hmm. The motion carries. 15C is Sydney Brown, PhD, for ACCP and licensure. Any recusals or abstentions? Hearing none, Dr. Medina, you are kind enough to summarize.
Yes. Dr. Brown received her doctoral degree in clinical psychology from Alliant International University, APA accredited, in June of 2024. Completed her 2,000-hour APA-accredited internship at the Rochester Psychology Internship Consortium in June 2023. Submitted supervised professional experience hours, 1,494 from the Psychological Assessment, Inc., with the hours meeting criteria in terms of direct hours and the appropriate supervision. Two references and a self-query were submitted. I did not see a fingerprint clearance card, nor a receipt, unless I missed it. But I'm okay. I have no objections with the application as long as that's provided, supplied by the candidate.
Board staff, do we need the card before we approve?
Mr. Chair, yes. May 1st was the date that was designated to be the implementation date of the new requirement. So maybe what Ms. Folks can do is check to see if it was received when we are, during the break. We can table this and come back to it. Alternatively, what I heard Dr. Medina say, I believe that's also an option that the board can adopt a motion that's contingent on receipt of the fingerprint clearance card or the receipt, as long as there are no wraps, as they're called, to the card. So I think first let's let Ms. Folks look for the look for the card. So let's table this.
Okay, let's table this and come back to it. And it's 12 o'clock. Let's take a comfort break. We'll be back at 12:15. We have quorum. It is 12:16, and we are in open session. 15C, Ms. Folks, did we find out the information about the card?
Mr. Chair, I'll go ahead and I'm sorry, she's ready.
Sorry, I was having trouble unmuting. Mr. Chair, board members, that is a piece I did overlook. Her application was submitted before this went into effect, and somehow I didn't catch this one. I have emailed her and asked her to send it. If the board, it's up to the board's discretion to table the application or perhaps approve it contingent on receiving the fingerprint clearance card or receipt.
So, Dr. Medina, what's your pleasure on this?
I would be inclined to approving a contingent on us receiving the fingerprint clearance card or receipt.
Second.
Okay. So, motion and a second. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? None opposed. The motion carries. Where should we go next, Ms. Pakkanen?
Mr. Chair, maybe just back to 11, and then we can move in sequence through the next several items.
Okay. 11 is discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding draft proposed substantive policy statement clarifying ARS Section 32-2091.08 specific to exemptions to licensure. And Dr. Davey is going to provide us a summary on this.
Thank you very much. So, hopefully Heidi's going to help me. So the heart of this is that we are trying to submit a proposal around a policy statement that we would like to ultimately run by Jean. And it's, correct me, Heidi, Jean has not weighed in on this, right? This is the
actually worst. Dr. Davies, she has. So there were just a few, I think, very non-substantive edits, I think, that were good edits. So.
Marvelous. I thought we were seeking approval to move it on to her, but we're really, I guess, seeking approval to release this into the wild. This statement seeks two things. One, to clearly state the behavior analyst licensure exemptions as established by IRS 32-2091.0A3 or 8A3 and 32-2091.8A6. And really, we're trying to reiterate to people again that there's only certain people that can practice behavior analysis in the state, and as such, part of practice is supervision. And so you must be licensed to provide supervision in the state. Second point of this is to clarify that individuals that may be board certified behavior analysts can in fact work under the close supervision of a licensed behavior analyst in the state. That is permissible through our statutes. And so this clarifying policy statement seeks to clarify that for the public as we continue, for the public as well as for our licensees, as we continue to see just a significant portion of our complaints that are being brought really related to this issue of supervision or of practice. Happy to answer any questions. Also, we worked with past board member, past CBA member, Dr. Davis Wilson on this. The Committee on Behavior Analysts has reviewed this as well, and it is now, and now Dr. or Ms. Gavin has also reviewed it. Now it is on your desk for a review and hopefully publication to the public.
Mr. Chair, would you like me to also provide an explanation of what is a substantive policy statement?
Yes, please.
Thank you. It just occurred to me with at least one new board member who has maybe never experienced this kind of an adoption process. So a substantive policy statement is its purpose is to clarify an agency, in this case, our board's interpretation of statute or rule. It is not an enforceable document, but again, its intent is to, you know, clarify how the board, you know, interprets and applies a particular provision of statute or rule. There is a formal process that is required to be followed when formalizing a substantive policy statement. It does need to be submitted to the Arizona Secretary of State's office for publishing in the Arizona Register. So that is, if it's to be approved, you know, I will, you know, follow those steps to formalize this document. But in the meantime, it would live on our website and serve as that guidance. I think in the case of of this particular issue because it is so frequently one that the Committee on Behavior Analysts addresses or evaluates with applications, with complaints. You know, I think this document is really some, it represents an effort to try to educate the behavior analytic community on what is acceptable and what isn't, you know, in terms of licensure, exemptions to licensure, and so forth. So it really represents, I think, a tremendous amount of work. As Dr. Davey said, a lot of thought went into this. It was not hastily drafted. So it seems to be a very thoughtful and comprehensive approach to trying to educate the practice community about, you know, again, what is acceptable and what is not.
Yeah, appreciate that, Ms. Pakkanen, and also appreciate all of the effort that went into this, Dr. Davey and Dr. Davis-Wilson, and, you know, the others who weren't necessarily mentioned, but I know worked on this proposal. So I guess the next step is a motion, Dr. Davey, of the board to approve this.
That sounds like a great motion. Would you like me to second that?
I'll make that motion. And Dr. Davey seconds it. Okay, any further discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? None opposed, the motion carries.
That was slick, Dr. Davey. I'm taking notes.
You like that, huh?
I did.
Okay, so number 12.
It's only because our chair is extremely well organized and articulate that I was able to do that.
Yeah. He most certainly is.
Agreed.
Give me credit that is not due, but, you know. number 12. Number 12 is discussion, consideration, possible action regarding ASPPP potential regulatory implications of licensing masters trained individuals task force. Somebody has to change that name. Prelim report. Ms. Pakkanen, will you please provide us a summary?
I certainly will, Mr. Chair. So by way of reminder, last month, the board first saw this information and after some discussion, elected that to tentatively move forward or to move forward, at least in the sense that gathering stakeholder input with respect to licensing master's level educated and trained psychologists. This would be a first where Arizona is concerned, opening up a category of licensure for those individuals. So the materials that you have include the work of the task force that I served on, along with several other subject matter experts in various capacities to prepare what is model language for licensure, both statute language and rule language, recognizing that the way this document is written, it can't be adopted in Arizona verbatim. So we would need to use this language again as a model to craft the kind of language that would be necessary to live in our chapter, under our regulated chapter, and ultimately the administrative rules that are promulgated. So at any rate, the consensus was, let's move forward and let's look at a potential plan for what that might look like. So after some contemplation by me, and as you would expect from me, I needed to draw some pictures. I prepared what I think is my best representation for a timeline for how I see this this playing out. So there are three pages of a Gantt chart following my memorandum. So it begins on page 2. So that chart is my my vision with respect to the stakeholder discussion, fact gathering phase of this effort. So the way I see this potentially unfolding is that we sort of get ready in the spring of 2025, as which we don't have a lot of that time left, but we prepare for what would be hopefully robust and very inclusive stakeholder discussions that play out in the summer of 2025. So what I've attempted to do too at the top is illustrate the progression of the accreditation of education programs that are that the American Psychological Association's accreditation AOC Council on Accreditation COA whatever there's an acronym there anyway that the accreditation arm of the APA. They are meanwhile accepting applications and evaluating programs for purposes of accreditation. So as Dr. Seidman pointed out to us at the last meeting, there are currently three programs that have been APA accredited, North Dakota, Capella, and I'm not going to remember the third one. But by the fall, winter, later in 2025, early 2026, there may be as many as 11 more, a total of 11 programs that are accredited. So it's sort of a phased in process where APA has the capacity to take so many applications from, you know, a certain number of programs to evaluate them for accreditation. So again, page one is sort of that the stakeholder gathering discussions phase. And then the next page would be the Sunrise application phase of this effort. It's not clear to me as I read the Sunrise statute, which I have repeatedly, it's not clear whether a Sunrise application is essential for this new license type to be considered by the legislature, but my instincts and the advice that I have received from individuals I trust tells me that a Sunrise application should be prepared and submitted. So that's a decent amount of work. And so the best I could do is work on that effort in the spring of 26 with the goal of by summer, late summer of 26, that the Sunrise application has been reviewed and approved by this board and is submitted ahead of the November 1, 2026 deadline. So there would be discussions happening around that time too with potential bill sponsors, although Representative Bliss, Selena Bliss, had signaled to me, I think a year ago or more, that she would definitely be open to considering this idea. Now that she's the chair of the House Health Committee, you know, she would be the first member of the legislature, I think, to have this conversation with. So in the meantime, as 2026 is progressing into summer and fall, there could be 17 accredited programs by that point in time, 17 accredited master's programs. And then the final page, and I'm sorry, the font is so very minuscule. I really want to redo this chart using a better set of software. But at any rate, as we move into the winter of 26-27, we can expect that the first cohorts of the first accredited programs could be graduating by then, which isn't to say that they are ready to apply necessarily. They would need, under this model, 4,000 hours of training, and they can't apply for their provisional certificate until they have acquired 1,000 hours of training. So not that we have a responsibility or a duty to ensure that we are able to offer master's licensure when the first cohorts are graduating and acquiring their training. But I'm suggesting that we wouldn't be necessarily behind if we followed this time frame. So as we're in the winter of 26 and 27, that would be ideally the point in time where the legislation is moving through the legislature, and then later in the fall, 2027, and then into early 2028, we are promulgating the rules associated with the statute changes. We are, of course, requesting the additional appropriation of resources that we would need to process these types of applications. And then by perhaps fall, winter of 2028, we could be processing applications by that point in time. So there may be some flaws in my logic, in the way that I've illustrated this. So I really would invite anyone with insights better than mine to comment about that, or to suggest, you know, maybe where this proposed timeline should be tweaked or could be tweaked. Just to make it, I guess, say this more succinctly, I don't see any possibility that a Sunrise application could be filed this fall. And I say that because we're submitting to a performance audit. The Auditor General will be initiating or kicking off that that audit in the fall. So I don't see me practically being able to prepare for an audit and also prepare a Sunrise application. But the way I see it is that we would not be depriving a whole lot of folks from being eligible to practice at the master's level in Arizona if this is the time frame that the board agrees makes sense. So I will take any questions or invite insights and thoughts into what I'm proposing.
So Ms. Packin, and I should say I'm very impressed with how you graphically captured this, because it really helped resolve like most of the questions, you know, what happens first and what happens next. It's like, just, yeah, very well done. Thank you. I'm a big fan of color coding, so thank you for that too. just one question. I know, like, with any like Sunrise application or any major legislation, it takes a village. So I want to make sure that we have all the help we need. So if, you know, ASPPB is willing to be on board with this, or, you know, APA is willing to be on board with this, can they help us potentially to get the Sunrise application?
Mr. Diner, I think that's a terrific question. And what I would hope is that during the stakeholder input process, that ASPA or, you know, APA, any of those groups step forward and agree to do as much of the work as they practically can. I feel a sense of responsibility to do the Sunrise application, and then I would love nothing more than for that, if it's approved, then have the stakeholders take the lead in the advocacy role to get this legislation enacted. And it's not on the board. We don't even know if the board would be welcome at that time to champion legislation. That is a fluid situation. And so, you know, we would have to take the temperature of the leadership that exists at that time. You know, would this be well received or not by the legislature? Who would the governor be potentially? So a lot of those factors are unknowns. But, you know, and I spoke to this at the last meeting, from an ownership perspective, to do this right, it really takes the regulators doing this first piece. And then from that point forward, I think it's really appropriate for the other stakeholders to carry the ball.
Dr. Seidman.
Thank you, Chairman Diner. I applaud your illustration skills, Heidi. Really nice. Wonderful. I'm quite envious, in fact. So I may be getting ahead of myself. Oh, by the way, Fairleigh Dickinson University is that third university that is APA accredited. But I may be getting ahead of myself, and this is I found myself feeling anxious. Would we only, and I don't know if you or can answer this, of course, but only APA accredited master's level programs? Because I'm going to guess there are going to be non-APA accredited programs that come out of the woodwork. So that's, I guess I don't expect an answer to that. It's just an anxious comment.
No, and Dr. Seidman, that is perhaps the most significant policy decision that I think this board would need to make. Obviously, where doctoral level prepared psychologists are concerned, it's very established in statute that accreditation, graduation from an accredited program is, you know, one pathway, but then there are other options which are just sort of generally described as equivalency. So like our jurisdiction and many others, we have a process by which we determine, is this program that is not APA accredited, is the content still and the experience still equivalent? So you've made that decision for doctoral level psychologists. Will you make the same decision at the master's level? That's entirely up for debate. So I don't know that you are compelled to do any one thing, but I'm using the APA accreditation progression as sort of to inform us, not necessarily assuming that programs that aren't APA accredited will never, their graduates would never be eligible for licensure in Arizona. They may be based on your decision. Yeah. So does that make sense?
It sure does. It sure does. And the timeline's quite reasonable, I think. And it makes a ton of sense for ASPA to get involved at that stage, because that's their constituents, and that would be very reasonable. So thank you.
And recognizing that, you know, ASPA is going to have some challenges because this concept may be controversial among its existing membership, right? So that's a challenge that I think we need to be respectful of and make sure that they have the time to work through that issue as they need to. It's not ours. It's not our issue. It's theirs. So if they need more time, then, you know, that's is something that needs to be considered.
Thank you.
Dr. Stewart.
Thank you, Mr. Dunnar. Heidi, any insights or observations of the pushback against master's level trained people being licensed as psychologists or associate psychologists?
Yes, Dr. Stewart. When our task force first published the proposed language, published it for purposes of obtaining public comment, I want to say there were close to 180 comments that came back. A lot of the comments were from professionals, practitioners in states that have been licensing at the master's level. Their requirements may not necessarily look like anything like what the model language envisions, but there was concern that would I, as a master's level psychologist, and I'm licensed in North Carolina or I'm in Michigan, would I be forced to, you know, can I be grandfathered in, if you will, you know, or legacy, I think is the preferred term. Must I go through, you know, this new process in order to continue practicing the way that I practice? So that was a lot of the comments, of course. A lot of questions around, is there an appropriate examination for these individuals. Today, the vision is that they would take the ERPP and their pass point would be at a place lower than what is required for doctoral level psychologists. The 17 states, I think, that license at the master's level, there's a big range of what is a passing score. I think I've heard one state, I don't want to call them out, it's as low, they set the bar as low as 350, whereas other states have said, you know, 400, 450. So eventually the plan or the intention of ASPPB is to form a master's level ERPP examination that is built entirely around a job task analysis that is a reflection of their scope of practice. So that's the best solution. Obviously, there were concerns by doctoral educated and trained psychologists that the scope of practice of master's level psychologists will be too big and largely reflect
Heidi, you're freezing.
Yeah.
Your connection is weak. Or is it me?
No, you're
fine. Oh, yeah, no, I agree.
Oh.
So maybe give her a minute or two to get back.
Okay. Yes, I got the internet is unstable.
Yeah.
Okay, well, hopefully we're done. Hopefully we're past that. So anyway, I think nothing that I said probably surprised you. I mean, there's also some sort of concerns that what are the motivations of the APA for opening this door, you know, for opening, yes. So, you know, is this reflective of, you know, a big shift that the organization is interested in making. But the fact of the matter is that I think the other forces that are very, that every, all stakeholders need to consider is that we know there to be not enough mental health professionals. So is this a solution? There are also some concerns that what we've envisioned as a pathway to licensure, this model that if someone is evaluating, do I take that path or do I acquire instead a master's degree in counseling? The path of least resistance is not necessarily the one that you are looking at today. So are we truly, if we build it, will they truly come? We don't know that.
So it's in going back, if I may, so a lower passing score, so it'd be similar to nursing in the NCLEX. So the RNs pass at a certain level, a certain percentage, LPNs pass at a lower percentage than that. So that's in existence in other states that license master's level?
Correct.
On the motivation of APA, I don't think I'm paranoid or have a paranoid ideation, but I have to believe that are they trying to capture more members to build up their coffers? Certainly, membership has been lagging, and they've done everything under the sun to entice psychologists to belong to APA. The same thing with AZPA. Are they looking to capture more members in their nets for their own personal goals or what? Is it purely as altruistic as wanting more mental health people to service populations? I don't know the answer to that. But I have to imagine that's some of the pushback as well.
Everything you said was very reflective of what the public comments, what we saw. And we read and considered every one of them.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Dinar. That's the end of my question.
Thank you. Ms. Pakkinen, do you need like a motion or like I think there's a consensus on sort of supporting the next steps on this?
I think a consensus is fine. You know, the board sort of, you know, formalize its position and its ownership, if you will, at least in these initial phases of moving forward in a way that is in the best interest of the public. So I don't think a motion is necessary today. What I will say to the psychologist board members, if you look at the chart, what I will be asking you to do, and I'll probably, I think I want to create a form for you to do this just so I have that information nicely organized for then me to use, is that you spend a few weeks thinking about who needs to be at the stakeholder discussions table. It's perfectly fine if, you know, we see the same names over and over again, but I don't know that I'm incapable, frankly, of identifying everyone who needs to be there. And I really think that all five psychologists should be involved in making sure that all of those voices and perspectives get an invitation and an opportunity to meet with us later in the summer to talk about this. So I'm going to be giving some of you an assignment very soon.
Dr. Stewart.
Thank you, Mr. Dinar. Certainly in the stakeholders meeting, it seems like it would be appropriate and probably necessary to include members of the Behavioral Health Examiners Board to have input. They may have a different point of view than what I as a psychologist would hold.
Yeah, good suggestion. So I don't know that you're going to see this necessarily every month, this item. I think there's going to be sort of, you know, checkpoints where this needs to come back for, you know, some board consideration, direction, action. So I think as we move in, you know, through this stakeholder discussions phase, it may be later in the summer before, you know, we have information that we need to evaluate.
Very good. So I guess that concludes our number 12.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, yeah, code word.
Yes. The next CE code word is Tower Bridge. Tower Bridge. Thank you very much.
I'm seeing a theme developing. Okay, number 13 is discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding Joint Legislative Ad Hoc Committee on Family Court Orders. And Ms. Pakkinen, so your summary, please.
Yes, Mr. Chair. So I have provided the board with a couple of emails, maybe more than a few. I lose track relative to this topic. So this committee, ad hoc committee, appears to have been formed early in April. I will read you the description of the news release that is associated with the formation of this committee. It reads that in response to a significant number of parents and parent advocates expressing concerns about experiences with family court proceedings, a joint legislative ad hoc committee is being called to take public comment and expert testimony on issues related to family court proceedings and laws in Arizona. This will include, but is not limited to, court-ordered therapeutic intervention. In a series of five committee hearings, members will determine whether legislative reforms are needed to address the impact of family court orders on Families and Children. And then a quote from the committee's chairman, Senator Fincham, reads, "I am urging those who have been impacted by the family court system to come to the Senate and make their voices heard as part of our ongoing efforts to evaluate potential legislative solutions to safeguard families and hold government agencies and non-government agencies accountable for potentially unreasonable practices." So it is that last piece that suggests to me that the work of this board is under some scrutiny, and that will be our opportunity appearing before this committee to answer to that. What is regrettable about the timing of the first two of these five meetings, as the board is aware, staff with quite short notice was not able to attend the first hearing, and that raised some concerns. Some concerns were articulated about our that we weren't there, which I anticipated. So the second meeting is May 12th. What's unfortunate about that schedule is that I am on vacation. And so what I have been working on is a plan whereby Ms. Michelson will present to the committee an overview of the claims process, because this is what we believe that the committee, what they need to be oriented to. So those slides are in your folder. I prepared those. We finalized those just very recently. So I know you didn't have a lot of time to read them, but it's also not a lot of content. We also think that the committee needs to know that we have a very, very detailed, meticulously detailed and articulated policy that we follow to process claims. So this is the material that I plan to submit this afternoon ahead of the May 12th presentation. I do have a meeting with Senator Fincham on Monday. It may be that, my suggestion for, what the psychology board can bring to the May 12th hearing, maybe it won't be well received. I really can't say. I had hoped to meet with the senator before May 5th, but our first scheduling attempt resulted in the rescheduling to Monday. So I'm not providing a whole lot of time before I depart to prepare Ms. Michelson. She will also, though, be supported by Drs. Medina and Stewart, have agreed to appear before the committee and speak as subject matter experts. So I hope that their comments and their testimony is welcome and well received, because they really do possess the expertise that I think this panel needs to hear from. So with that, I will take any questions or comments or observations.
Well, I'll say thank you for taking care of this. I know it seems like coming out of nowhere, but I'm sure the legislature has good reasons for this, for sort of like, making sure that they're speaking with the board and addressing some of the concerns that are out there. And Ms. Michelson, I think you'll be excellent in the testimony. It's not dissimilar to some of the things that we do here on the board. So I know you're well prepared. And thank you to Dr. Stewart and Dr. Medina for taking on the mantle and being available to testify. Just one insight, I think right now there is a rulemaking that is going on through the courts. So it's the Arizona Supreme Court rulemaking. So it's a change to the evidentiary rule regarding accepting reports filed by forensic psychological experts in family court and child dependency matters. And the trend, at least so the current proposal is to adopt a rule that would automatically accept those forensic reports. So there isn't sort of any sort of, like the are you really an expert on this type evaluation before accepting the expert report? So the trend, at least from the court's perspective on evidentiary matters, seems to be different. I just put it that way, from the trend of this ad hoc committee at the legislature. So there might be some interesting discussion around that, I'm assuming. But again, you know, my predictions can be like reading tea leaves sometimes, so take it for what you will. Any comments? I don't think you need a motion for this, Ms. Pakkanen, but
Not necessarily. I guess the only thing I would not want to forward the slides if the board had any consternation about any of the content. I mean, it's very straightforward. It's very fact driven, so data driven. But I just wanted to make sure that before I sent it to the committee, that, you know, the board didn't have any concerns with it.
Yeah, I looked at the slides. I didn't see any problems with it, but Dr. Stewart.
Thank you, Mr. Dunner. I think that the ad hoc committee, as Ms. Pakkanen indicated, came about from parent advocates and wanting to hold the mental health examiners, which are usually psychologists involved in child custody and family law issues, that the advocates want to hold these folks to a standard. But I have to remind myself, and it's pretty easy to do, when we get claims that come across that Dr. Medina and myself respond to, it's usually each, we're dealing with an adversarial arena. Divorce and child custody are hot button issues. And so, parents perceive themselves as being on the losing end when an examiner makes a recommendation to the family court. And sometimes they're just mad as a wet hen, and they react by bringing complaints against the attorney involved and also against the psychologist involved. So this is not uncommon. I don't see that ending. I still feel that psychologists, we're best trained to conduct family law assessments and also child custody assessments. Thank God the trier of fact is the one that makes these decisions, and it's not the forensic examiner. Thank you.
Dr. Seidman.
Thank you, Mr. Diner. Having listened to the hearing that Heidi had sent around, my impressions were that at least that particular session, the people who testified were complaining about the therapeutic interventionists and not the evaluators. So I found that kind of interesting. Having been on the complaint screening committee just very recently, I don't remember seeing a therapeutic interventionist. Ours was the evaluator and the report, and conflicting appearing to be conflicting findings that the complainant didn't agree to about. Because of the adversarial situation, that was frivolous. Complaint. So I think this idea of the committee understanding what a therapeutic interventionist is versus an evaluator is important for us to educate them on. Thank you.
Dr. Lipson.
Thank you, Mr. Diner. I'm going to second what Dr. Simon just said. I also listened to the hearing, and it was a whole bunch of parents who were mad at the therapeutic intervention, the TIs is what they're called, and for having to have supervised visitation for, you know, years at the tune of, like, in one case, $500,000. And so what I gleaned from the hearing is some of the senators on the committee were really trying to determine, like, what a TI is. Some of them are bachelor's level folks, but they were kind of lumping psychologists into, like, this whole pool of people that had wronged these families. So I think, you know, we could do a really good job at kind of providing some additional clarification as to what our role is. And I did hear a lot of complaints about, like, the initial child custody evaluation they weren't happy with. It was just, like, the long-term effects of, like, my child has had to, you know, we've had to do supervised visitation for 10 years, not the original psych eval they were upset with or the original psychologist. So, but I mean, there was a lot of other parents that didn't get a chance to speak their mind that day at that hearing. And I guess there was a whole bunch that showed up. So I guess time will tell. Time will tell. So that's all, Mr. Diner. Thank you.
Dr. Stewart.
Thank you, Mr. Diner. And it's important for me to realize that the complainants represent only 50% of the issues involved. The other issues are the ones that, quote unquote, won the case in terms of custody of the children. The therapeutic interventionists may indeed be master's level folks. They're usually employed in a clinic, a privately owned clinic, by a JD, PhD, or a PhD psychologist. And so the therapeutic interventionists work usually under the license of a psychologist. And again, this is only the people not complaining are the ones that are viewed as being the winners in the child custody lotto that we have. I don't know a way around that. And again, I take comfort that it is the trier of fact that has to make these decisions and issue the rulings and not me.
Dr. Livesey.
Thank you, Mr. Diner. I guess for me also, if there was a psychologist who had been involved in one of these cases that the parents spoke about where supervised visitation was having to last for this unending amount of time for 10 years at the tune of $500,000, that would be probably a case or a situation that our board would be interested in hearing about. I don't know if that was ever a complaint that was filed with this board, but that does seem like a really long time and a super expense. Like, people are talking about having to take out second and third mortgages on their home to be able to see their children. But I don't know if any psychologists were involved in those cases. It wasn't clear to me, but that would certainly be, if a complaint had come our way, that would probably be something that we would take very seriously.
Dr.
Thank
Simon.
You, Mr. Diner. Thank you.
Thank
Dr.
you.
Simon.
Yeah, thank you. I was just going to say that would allow the complainant to come forth and then we could tackle it. We just haven't, we don't see that. And so that needs to be presented to that committee as well, that here are complaints and this is what we're seeing. So we don't have involvement with those TI type or, you know, $500,000 cases that a person has to pay out. So. Thank you.
Dr. Stewart.
Thank you, Mr. Diner. And I don't know the answer to that. I share that concern as well. You can count on, here in Arizona, a child custody evaluation will cost a minimum of $10,000, and it goes up from there. And I think the advocates, the complainants, are indeed correct that it gets to be mind-boggling sometimes in terms of the enmeshed requirements that the TIs, bog their parents down in. But again, the ones complaining represent the people who are not complaining are still the parents, but they're the ones that gain the most custody. The ones that are not complaining are an equal share. So however many complain during a hearing, we can see that number on the other side as well, being against it. So we're attempting to thread the needle here and to explain to the committee, to the ad hoc committee, what exactly are the issues involved in child custody evaluations, the issues involved when, again, the JD, PhD, and the requirements can be mind-boggling, but we do need to separate out what psychologists do and what we don't do. And I think you're absolutely correct, Dr. Livesay and Dr. Seidman, that it's all blended together, and we need to be a part of the appropriate education for this committee. Thank you.
So, Ms. Pakkanen, I think you have the support that you need to, and Ms. Michelson, for this. And, whatever comes out of the meeting, I think it's important to have that dialogue with the legislature and hear out what other people have to say. And then we can regroup in our monthly meetings. And if any next steps come out of that, then we can certainly discuss that.
Yes. So I will report on my conversation with the chair, with Senator Fincham. You'll receive an update from me by email on Monday. And yes, we will just expect to see this as probably a frequent topic on future board meeting agendas. And I anticipate that we will be expected to be present for not only the hearing on the 12th, but the three that follow. Thank
All right,
you.
And, no, thank you. So that's 13. So next is 14, discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding proposed legislation and a bunch of numbers. And Ms. Pakkanen, take it away.
Yes, certainly. There are maybe three bills that I want to talk about only because there's so much of what is still alive on this list in terms of bills. A lot of them are just marking time, and I don't know what that means. I don't know if, if they're being held or, it's just sort of, it's not, they're not progressing to the next step in the process, whether it's the committee of the whole or the third reading or whatever the case may be. But it's just sort of curious. And this happens. It's not uncommon that, bills just sort of stagnate, but then they may all of a sudden, move forward. But House Bill 2451, this is one that I'm talking about, one that's been transmitted to the governor as a few days ago. What it does is it grants parties in contested cases or appealable agency actions one peremptory change of an administrative law judge. We have few cases that are heard in before an administrative law judge, but for what this is worth, it seems that this is this bill has been strongly supported by bipartisan support. So it's with Governor Hobbs now. Then all the way to, let's see, what else did I have? I've already talked about 2173, so that will compel us to change the question that we ask on applications and renewals about mental health diagnoses and treatment. Senate Bill 1235, you probably remember a meeting or two ago, the board had taken a neutral position on this bill. It's experienced so many different changes, many iterations. As it is considered the final step, which is the third reading in the House, it still represents the board composition as it exists in the statutes today. So nothing has changed since the last time you saw this bill. It retains the current composition of 5 psychologist members, 2 of whom are academic members, 2 behavior analysts, and 3 public members. So still status quo. That bill is curiously a little stalled, but it's still alive. The bill 1237, Senate Bill 1237, that would have required all state employees to cease remote work, with a few exceptions, and to return to work to an office. That doesn't seem to be, it's probably not going to move forward, with the realization that the Arizona Department of Administration estimates that the state would need to acquire 1.5 million square feet of space in order to place everyone back in an office. So the price tag associated with that is astronomical, and so that doesn't seem at all practical. Then one more bill that I definitely want to highlight, which has also been transmitted to the governor, is the House Bill 2441. And that is the one that would require this board, when a party that files a complaint, would be entitled to and shall be provided copies of all documents received and reviewed by the board in connection with the investigation, except as otherwise restricted under state or federal law. So the board discussed this bill when it was first introduced, and recently the Arizona Psychological Association issued a call to action to oppose this bill. If you look at the registration system for the request to speak system for and against, there are definitely more individuals who are opposed to this bill as compared to one individual who supports the bill. But nonetheless, it is passed now both chambers, and so that awaits Governor Hobbs' decision as well. So that is that will compel, if it's signed, that will compel a lot of research and consideration to ascertain how do we comply with this requirement while also ensuring that any information that is still confidential under state or federal law, that we preserve that confidentiality. So it's going to be complicated.
And that well, thank is you always. As always. Well, thank you as always for keeping tabs on all of this. We'll see what happens in the next month or two. So I think we have number 16, but we will probably, let's actually take a break. We'll be back at 1:30. Okay. Matters on a future agenda. Yes, Ms. Paikkanen.
I just want to inform the board that a matter that you requested that we place on a future agenda, you requested it some months ago, which is Walden University appearing for some board questions. They have confirmed their attendance for the June 6th meeting.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And I'm sure we'll have questions about contracts drafted.
And I just admitted Dr. Character.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Packinen, for that meeting, do we have, can we create an agenda for that meeting? Is that versus a free flow kind of conversation with them? Is that something perhaps that some of my psychology board member friends might want to put together so we could structure this conversation so that we do not get derailed? And I speak from experience having interviewed some organizations in the past through the CBA. And so all of a sudden, you know, what we come to talk about doesn't get talked about for 15 minutes or that gets glossed over as time's kind of waning. So if that's maybe a friendly suggestion to our team.
It looks like Dr. Seidman's volunteering.
I don't know about that.
Dr. Seidman.
Well, that wasn't what I was volunteering for. However, I want to piggyback on that request. It's my understanding, unless I misheard it a few times ago, meetings ago, that this board has met with Walden University before. Is that true? At least once? And perhaps in our packets, we could have that material, the meeting minutes from that meeting, so we could see what's been talked about and follow up on perhaps some of those items and bring our new items together too.
Muted. I will ask Ms. Folks to research that history. And then also Ms. Folks and I have, most of Ms. Folks, teased out some questions that have been raised from conversations at ARC and at the board meeting that we knew to be questions that had Walden University's representative been present, you would have posed them to that person. So we can do at least that much. But if any board member has, you know, anything sort of any vision for an agenda, you know, please send it to us so we can prepare it.
Heidi, thank you for that, Ms. Packinen. I would be willing, if the timing is correct, if I could get a draft of that and then I could develop a draft of an agenda, that would be great.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Seidman. You volunteered after all.
What's that called? Forced voluntary?
Dr. Medina.
Thank you, Ms. Rodiner. I'm not volunteering for anything. I just have a question, which is, should we send possible questions to Dr. Seidman to perhaps address in the meeting, or should we keep those for the meeting? However,
if any individual board member, if I may, has questions, I would ask that you send them to Heidi. Okay. And Heidi can collect them and send them to Dr. Seidman so we don't have an open meeting law issue.
Okay, great. Thank you.
That'd be great. That's a great suggestion.
Thank you.
Dr. Stewart.
Thank you, Mr. Denar. I don't know if this is feasible, but in terms of economy of time and energy, should we forward those questions on to Walden University where they can prepare responses?
I would imagine if the timing is reasonable, yeah, that would, if we could do that, that would make sense for sure.
I mean, I guess basically, and Ms. Galvin, you can probably correct me, but we basically just want to give them, you know, like, okay, these are the three topics that will come up. It's not like, you know, give them every possible question. It's just, okay, these are the topics, and hope, you know, we have a conversation about these, and that basically is sufficient.
Agreed.
All right, any other items on the future agenda? Hearing none, let's go to number 16. Discussion, consideration, and possible action relating to renewal application submitted by Colleen Character, PhD. And Ms. Poe, will you please provide us an overview?
Yes, Mr. Chairman and members of the board, the board office recently received Dr. Character's license renewal application, in which she answered yes to questions 9 and 10 of the application pertaining to investigations. Upon request, she supplied information to board staff regarding an open investigation by the Texas Board of Psychology, where she also holds a license. The board has been provided all information pertaining to that investigation, which again is still ongoing. Dr. Character did also email board staff recently an update, just letting us know that although the investigation is ongoing, she did recently have her license renewal application in Texas approved through April 30th of 2027. Board staff is seeking direction from the board on whether or not her renewal application here can be approved and if additional action is necessary. Dr. Character is in attendance at today's meeting if board staff has questions or if she would like to provide any additional information or make a statement. And that concludes my summary of the matter.
Thank you, Ms. Poe. And Dr. Character, I see you. Thank you for being here. If you want to make a statement, now would be a time, and then I'm sure we'll have questions.
Good afternoon, everyone. I was recruited during the pandemic to do telehealth for an agency. They told me I was able to do this because of, I don't have the information in front of me because I was working, but because of, I know it was the Emergency Act declared by Trump during the pandemic, as well as Congress, who I think it was called the Appropriations Act, and President Biden. It was extended until May of last year. So when I initially filled out the application after I knew the pandemic was ending, on the survey it asked if, you know, on the application it asked if you had ever practiced. I said, yes, I practice in telehealth. Just told them the same thing I told you. They told me, okay. They gave me a license. And then last year, over a year later, the health Behavioral Executive Council filed a complaint saying that I should not have practiced in Texas. And what I learned was that the governor of Texas stopped the telehealth with regard to, you know, practitioners in January of 2021. I did not know that at the time. However, I thought federal law would trump state law. What I have found out is that Texas is another world, I guess, and they were not, they just filed a complaint. So I do have a meeting with them. It's called a settlement conference. It was just arranged yesterday. It's going to be May 14th. I have an attorney. My attorney told me that I would have paid the fee, the $2,000 fine. I have no problem with paying that. My problem lies in that I don't think that they should be able to put on my license that I practice in Texas without a license. I mean, to me, it's like, how can you put something on my license I didn't have and fine me too? So that is has been my argument. Also with regard to, I would have never done this if I had not thought I could do it based upon the federal laws at the time. So that's where we are. My lawyer thinks that they're still going to fine me, which is okay with me, because I, you know, I don't see the point in continuing to fight them when I already have when they renewed my license. So we'll find out what happens May 2nd. But she was saying that even if they do fine me, it will be that part will be put on my license. So it seems like it's a no-win situation because they're still saying that. Their state law trumped the federal laws. And that's where I am.
Yeah, appreciate your candor, Dr. Character. And I think, you know, it's mostly what I'm seeing is you did your you took appropriate steps to inform us in your renewal application that there's this pending thing. Now, you know, the action that Texas takes is basically up to them. But, you know, I trust you to keep us informed as to any developments that might occur with the Texas matter as it, you know, comes close to resolving or whenever it gets resolved. So the question for us is, you know, there's a renewal application to be granted. And board members, any questions for Dr. Carrington?
Mr. Chair, this is Dr. Davey. No questions. I appreciate her forthcomingness around this. I think that the motion would be to accept her application with the asterisk that she keep us informed of Texas's final adjudication of the matter.
Second.
So motion and a second. Any discussion, Dr. Davey? So, Dr. Carrington, I think you heard what was said, like, just keep us informed and, you know, whatever happens at that point, we can cross that bridge.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for your time and consideration. Hope you guys are having a wonderful day. It's probably hot out there like it is here.
Well, we have a motion on the table. You haven't voted yet.
Okay.
Any further discussion, board members? All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? None opposed. The motion carries.
Mr.
Chairman, yes,
I will let you know as soon as I find out what happens. I guess next week. I don't know if they'll make a decision that day, but like I said, more than likely I will, you know, go ahead and pay the fine. That's what my attorney is saying, because she's saying that Texas law trumps the federal law. So I didn't know. So thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Carrington. I will update you via email this afternoon. And I would also like to give out the last CE code word. The last CE code word is Millennium Bridge. Millennium Bridge. Thank you.
All right. So that takes us to adjournment. And I'll exercise my moderator's privilege to adjourn. It is 1:44 p.m. and we are adjourned.